All right. Good afternoon, members. I'm going to bring the House Energy Committee to order. Ms. Burry, would you please take the roll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Skies.
Here.
Vice Chair Zolnikoff.
Excused.
Vice Chair Heyman.
Here.
Representative Binkley.
Here.
Representative Brewster.
Here.
Representative Custer.
Here.
Representative Durham.
Here.
Representative Kazmaier.
Here.
Representative Cordham.
Here.
Representative Olson.
Here.
Representative Phelan.
Here.
Representative Sullivan.
Here.
Excellent. We have a quorum ready to do business. And I see our bill sponsors here, so we have no delay, although many wanted a little bit of a break. So, folks, I don't know if you see the schedule. The order we're going to go in is House Bill 653, Senate Bill 266, Senate Bill 265, and we did have Senate Bill 297 scheduled, but that bill is going to end up being caught up in the future COVID money for broadband, so that one's going to take a little while to get to our committee. So as they stuff a couple $300 million into it, then it'll come to us, and then we'll have a lot of fun with it. So with that, we're only going to have three bills today. So if the sponsor is ready, let's open the hearing on House Bill 653. Representative Fitzgerald, welcome to House Energy, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Ross Fitzgerald, FITZGERALD, District 17, Ponderay, Teton, and the northern part of Lewis and Clark counties. I bring before you today a rather patchwork quilt of a bill. Bill number is 653, revising utilities right-of-way requests. And I will apologize up front to members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, for it is not in prime time just yet. There will be several amendments, as you'll hear later. But basically, in the state of Montana, there's been many disputes, variances, discussions about the cost of licenses and permits. Some people call them easements, but we have water districts, we have sewer districts, we have overhead electric, we have telecommunications that have already been installed that have been charged not only a fee and a requirement for installation under and over that is sometimes quite expensive, but what we've seen in the, we did a survey with the rural water districts exclusively, and I think there's probably in excess of 250 districts somewhere in the state of Montana, and we got a receipt of about 65 to 70 returns on our survey regarding costs of permits and licenses across railroad right-of-ways. Having said that, the railroad doesn't own those particular licenses and permits. There's another company that evidently acquired the option and rights to those, which I will not name, but this is where the dispute we finally figured out was. Some of the folks are getting hit 18% per year compounded on their fees to just have that permit and license. And some are being charged none, some are being charged thousands. So it's a kind of a variable picture, and I've been asked to address that as far as the past folks that have had the licenses and permits. So when you look basically, and I apologize again for not having this into a finished product, but it refers mostly to Section 4, excuse me, 4A on line, or page 5, line 17. It kind of gives you a little hint as to where I'm going to be concentrating my efforts on annual fee agreements to try to hopefully do this outside the court and outside the legislature, but I want to make it somewhat specifically clear that there's contractual arrangements that we think have been violated, and so therefore we want to remedy that in some fashion. And it's not a vengeful thing, it's just a fair business effort. So we're in constant communications with this new company, Discovered, and hopefully we will will resolve that. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will hear from soft opponents, as they tell me, and they will explain their objections, which I probably wouldn't argue with at this point because we have an unfinished product here, and that's my fault. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I won't whine any longer.
Thank you, Representative. All right, folks, if you're in the room and testifying, please make sure you sign in. When you start with your testimony, please state and spell your name and the group that you're affiliated that you're with. If you're not with the affiliated group, just tell us you're here for yourself. And I guess with that, we'll start with proponents in the room, please. Proponents. Representative Fitzgerald, you travel like I do, bro. And I only see two folks overall, Ms. Eggebrecht, that are involved virtually today. It's a slow day virtually. All right, neither one of them are on this bill. So let's go to opponents in the room, please. Opponents on House Bill 653.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ross Lane. That's R-O-S-S-L-A-N-E. I'm Vice President of Corporate Relations for Montana Rail Link. And if you don't know who we are, we're a little old hometown railroad that operates over 900 miles of railroad between Jones Junction near Billings, Montana, to Sandpoint, Idaho, and we employ about 1,200 hardworking Montanans. I rise today in opposition to House Bill 653. I have spoken to the sponsor, and he mentioned that the bill, and he just did in his testimony, is likely to change substantially. However, as it is written now, we must vigorously oppose it as Montana Rail Link, and to the extent it does change considerably, we're hopeful we can provide further comment. Today, I want to start first with safety. Since 1997, we've seen an over 90% reduction in incidents and accidents at Montana Rail Link. In fact, in 2019, we had the lowest injury frequency rate among the eight largest railroads in North America. We actually are the eighth largest railroad in North America. But we do recognize that one injury is one too many, and our work won't be completed until we eliminate all accidents and injuries at Montana Rail Link. This year, like past years, we will continue to invest tens of millions of dollars in our private infrastructure to ensure our railroad operations continue to operate smoothly and efficiently. In just the last 5 years alone, we've invested well over $250 million in our railroad, things like replacing hundreds of thousands of new ties, installing miles of new rail, and investing in new technologies like positive train control. So that said, railroads should be in charge and in control of their own safety decisions, and I believe our record shows that. However, what this bill does in its current form would partially transfer that decision-making authority to an unknown outside panel. So how do we do permitting at Montana Rail Link? So we employ three full-time professionals to manage our real estate across our network. We currently manage over 2,800 permits on our system and receive hundreds of new permits applications each year. For each permit that we do receive, we review it for not only what our railroad looks like today, but also what it looks like 5, 10, 15, 20, even 100 years from now. Our legal, real estate, engineering, and transportation teams all must sign off on the proposed permit to make sure it guarantees the safe operation of our railroad, while also allowing for future growth. I can't disclose in this forum what our fees for permits are, but I can tell you they are nominal and do not fully repay the time spent that we take to review those permits. In short, as you know, we are not in the business of permitting real estate. We're in the business of moving the essential goods Americans count on every day. If you were to visit our website right now, you'd find an application for a pipeline wireline permit along with several other real estate requests. Once an application is received, we process the application in approximately 30 to 40 days for MRL-owned branch lines. On our main line, we process permits in around 90 days and then submit to our partners at BNSF, who must also go through their own internal review process. This process is not meant to be burdensome, but is meant to ensure the safety of our employees, contractors, and the general public. A project mishandled, done without proper notice, review, or permission, puts our employees, members of the public, and contractors at risk of catastrophic injury or death. At MRL, we stand by to assist utilities or any other jurisdictions in navigating the application process to ensure, once again, we can operate safely while also getting their projects done on time and on budget. So in closing, unfortunately, while we understand the sponsor's intention, what this bill, again, as written, does, we believe is a complete erosion of private property rights in Montana. If you simply remove the word railroad in this bill and some others that have been like it and wrote homeowner, farm, or ranch, I can assure you that the halls of this Capitol would overflow with opposition. This bill takes what is now a private transaction between two private parties and injects government regulation. Since our founding in 1987, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in our infrastructure. We've also paid well over $100 million in just the last 10 years in property taxes. Just like any other private property owner in the state, we have a right to fair market compensation for real estate transactions and a right to protect our private property, and that's guaranteed in the Constitution of the state of Montana. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to speak today, and I stand by for any questions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. It's nice to meet you in person. We've only interacted in virtually. All right, the next proponent, please. Or, I'm sorry, opponent. My bad.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Wade, W-A-D-E, here on behalf of BNSF Railway. I want to echo what Mr. Lane said. His comments with respect to safety and private property rights are kind of paramount within BNSF. I want to take you back just a little bit, though. This whole discussion started, I think, in earnest last session about utility crossings of railroad property. And since, and at that time, BNSF committed to work with interested folks in addressing the utility crossing permitting process. And along those lines, BNSF has now rolled out an online tool that makes it easier to submit applications, track applications, and as well as process them and get answers to questions. So we have that. We've also worked with other stakeholders in the interim and have addressed a number of concerns, which I think is why you see normally the people you'd see, think as proponents aren't here. And as the folks on the Energy Interim Committee are aware, this item has been discussed a number of times. We think a lot of work's gone into it, a lot of good outcomes have come into it, and a lot of partnerships have been developed. And we understand Representative Fitzgerald's issue. We've been talking with him. We're committed to try to assist in trying to get some resolution, although we have some limitations because of their own contractual relationship. But I think with that being said, we, as written, we oppose House Bill 653. We appreciate kind of the idea, but it is an issue that we think is best left to private entities to work out amongst themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. And I do wish that we had brought this up sooner in ETIC. We could have done a better job with it. It's a shame that we didn't really talk about it till the middle of summer. And with COVID going crazy, it definitely needs more discussion, I think. Any other opponents in the room, please? All right, seeing no other opponents, are there any informational witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dwayne Kaley, spelled D-W-A-N-E-K-A-I-L-E-Y, and I'm the chief engineer at the Montana Department of Transportation. You may wonder why we are here today. In the bill, page 2, line 6, it says the Department of Transportation has the authority to determine whether or not a rail line is inactive. To set the record straight, we do not have that authority, nor do we want that authority. I talked to the sponsor, and I believe he is willing to amend us out of there, and with that, I have no further comments, but I'll be available for questions should you have any.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming in. And I won't move you to the opponent list yet. We'll wait and see how it goes. And is there any other informational witnesses? All right, seeing none, let's go to questions from the committee. Vice Chair Heyman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Lane.
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
You addressed this in every way, but calling it directly what I'd be calling it, which is a takings bill. Would you be qualifying it that way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, due to my lack of legal education, I wouldn't want to wager a guess on that, but I am confident that the attorneys both at Montana Rail Link and probably my colleagues at BNSF might view it in that way.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Could you give me an example of what we're talking about in this bill? Just a hypothetical.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so if I am a utility or any other entity that would want to cross our private property, which happens to be mostly railroad, an entity would apply for a permit, and according to, you know, our procedures internally, we would review it, as I said, and then issue the permit based on what that entity submitted. So we would, from an engineering perspective, want to make sure that we could continue to operate a railroad. So you would want to make sure the wire line or pipeline is deep enough that it doesn't impact the balance of our railroad, and the list goes on. So we charge a nominal fee for an applicant when they do apply. And if there's an impact to our property, we determine the impact, and then there's an additional cost that goes along to that entity. So those can be as simple as just a single crossing perpendicular to our railroad, or they can go as long as miles, as parallel to our railroad. And there is an impact to that. And the concerns that we have here are just that when we look at perhaps a 30-day shot clock on this, that's just really not something that's tenable on our end to be able to get those applications done. And the thing that concerns us the most from a safety perspective is that at 15 days, as is written in this bill, we're supposed to notify the applicant of those concerns, and then it has to go to arbitration if the utility or other applicant simply disagrees with that. And our position is that at Montana Rail Link, we know what is safe for our own property, and I don't want to keep going, but you know, one of the concerns we had, and we talked about this summer in the interim, is in 2019 near Park City, Montana, on our railroad, we were notified by a contractor that was on our property without our notifying our employees. They actually conducted an inspection of their pipeline that was near our property and exposed our employees to actual radiation as part of that process. So we have a lot of concerns about who's on our property, what they're doing, and if there's an impact to our property, we believe that it's a private transaction between those two entities to come to an agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Thank you, Chair Skeev.
All right, Representative Olson.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Wade, please.
Excellent. Mr. Wade, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wade, I'm always happy to see BNSF Railway in the room, and I know you're just representing them, but I'm often not completely prepared for your presence, so it's unfortunate. But my question, I guess, I have for you today is: we heard from the Department of Transportation that that there may be lines that are inactive, and that it's up to you guys whether they're active or not. Isn't there always a possibility that inactive lines will be reactivated, as we are seeing in other places in the country?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, without getting too much into the operational plans or details, which I am not privy to standing here today, but that is one of the concerns that we try to think about is as the economy changes, other things change, there are times when you're going to reopen a line or evaluate that, and so we're constantly evaluating what makes sense for the transportation model.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, if the committee's done, I have a question for Mr. Wade. If you would, we found out tonight that the Montana Rail Link is the eighth largest railroad in North America. What number are you, sir?
Mr. Chair, it's embarrassing, but I'm not entirely sure. Probably number one, I would guess, but...
It's tough to be the king, huh?
We are a small mom-pa privately owned railroad.
If you could find that out, please, I'm sure that'll be a Trivia Pursuit question in the future. I want to get a answer correct. Are there any questions from the committee? All right, well, then I just have one final one for the sponsor, if we would, please, sir. Representative Fitzgerald, so if do you want us to work with you on amending this bill? Are you going to bring us amendment ideas? How would you like us to progress with the bill, sir?
Mr. Chairman, members, my goal is to make this one page.
Oh, nice.
So you will probably find me striking, slashing, cutting. So I will try to get a hold of one of your members or yourself, okay. Mr. Chair.
And then there's one other thing. I think the way I read it, and I'm not quite sure, is this a revenue bill? Because if it is, I have a deadline of the 1st.
It is, sir.
Okay. So just so you know, if you grab a calendar, we've got, I believe we have until next, on Friday the 2nd, we're going on Easter break, so my last meeting is the 31st, so it's a week from today. So we'd have to have action on this bill by that 31st so I can keep to that deadline.
Understood, Mr. Chair.
So we have the 26th, which we're going to take off. I know the committee's upset about that. So we really have the 29th and the 31st to work on your bill.
Fair enough.
We'd love to. I just want to keep you in the loop for the timeline.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. With that, sir, would you like to close on your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, understandably, I understand the position of the opponents, and we have talked. And, you know, it's interesting that the terminology of fair market compensation comes up in private contracts. Normally, contracts are held to the meaning of what's on paper. This is where it has nothing to do with MRL and BNSF, I'll tell you that right now. But an example, just as I close here, we have a rural water system that's been in business for 40 years, serving over 200 families. There's four lines across the tracks and one line that runs along the side. There was a reasonable easement agreement for many years, but at some point, the past business, a business that I won't name, took over, and of course, in what capacity, nobody understood the billing of these easements. These easements for this particular water district have been going up 10% a year. The one to the south of it's 18% a year, and it wasn't in the original contract to have those raises. Understandably, this should have been settled outside on the street, but so far the negotiations haven't yielded anything for these folks. And there's another major one over there further west that has major pipelines. So it would become very onerous with them, and there's now, I've got a massive amount of water districts and sewer districts here that, again, as I repeated before, have a variability. We hope to take care of this by private conversation here the next week, but having said that, I'm just looking for a little backup based on good business law to support these small communities, and they are ma and pa towns. Understandably, the big cities and towns aren't involved in this. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members, I will take this soft flogging and my paperwork, and I will be in touch with you. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. This closes the hearing on Bill 653. And members, before we bring in the good senator and start up our next bill, I just want to remind everybody, if you remember, we have an incredibly cool staff in this building, and one of them is young Miss Amy. Remember, we bought her flowers in the very beginning as an appreciation. Well, over Valentine's Day, she wanted to buy us a treat, but then ended up getting the COVID and had to quarantine. And so the little treats on your desk are her treats that she wanted to give us on Valentine's Day. So that's Miss Amy, if you want to appreciate it. And for those of you virtually, I'm so sorry you missed out. Maybe she has extra cookies. If you're in the building, you can ask her. All right. So with that, and then Ms. Egerbecht, if you would, if you see Ms. Corbin, who's listed to talk on Senate Bill 297, I don't see her online yet. Please let her know that we're not doing that bill. That way she doesn't have to wait online for a long time and then be frustrated that there's no bill. And thank you. Thank you. So with that, Senator, do you care which bill you do first?
The order you have on the board is Fine, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. All right, folks, let's go ahead and open the hearing for Senate Bill 266. Senator, welcome to House Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to be back here. For the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10 from Great Falls. The next bill I have for you is Senate Bill 266. And I think you can see what this bill does from the title. What it does is it allows the state to use the Montana Consumer Protection Act in order to prevent really unfair trade practices in the way electrical generation facilities are being run. And what it says very simply is that if a facility, unless there's unanimous consent to close an electrical generation facility or unanimous consent to not perform maintenance, those can be subject to this law, this Unfair Trade Practices Act, and then there's a penalty in it. And I think everybody knows what's going on here. We know that out in Colstrip, there's been a really big push by the West Coast utilities to get out of Colstrip, and they're being pushed by their regulators in Washington and Oregon. And what they're fundamentally doing is coming into the state of Montana and destroying an asset that is a value to the people of Montana, an asset that employs people, pays a tremendous amount of taxes, is important for our economy. It's important for users of energy facilities in the state of Montana. Colstrip provides baseload power, which keeps us warm in the winter and can then fuel your air conditioning needs in the summer as well. So it's an important facility. It's important for the people of Montana. And unfortunately, what we have going on is, and I use this analogy in the Senate, and I hope it makes sense to you, we have a divorce going on. We have the West Coast owners, they don't want to be part of the facility anymore. They want out, and that's fine. They can leave. But instead of being civil about it, what they're doing is kind of the analogy of breaking all the plates, trashing the house, and keying up with the car on the way outside the door. So that's what's going on. And they're not paying their maintenance. They don't want to pay their maintenance costs. They don't want to pay for the things that keeps this facility running. And they've got lots of excuses. But I think you'll hear today that they're not really legitimate excuses. At the end of the day, this is an important asset for the people of Montana, and we can't have people destroying property in the state of Montana. That's just bad public policy. We would never allow, for example, a creditor let's just say you owed somebody $5,000, $10,000, we would never allow that person to go destroy the car that you might want to levy on or break the property. In fact, that's a crime. If you were to do that as a debtor to a creditor, you could be prosecuted. So that's what's going on here. We can't let the West Coast utilities destroy this important asset. It's really an asset of the state of Montana, and we need to do what we can to at least keep it alive until they're gone and other people want to run the property. So that's the bill. I hope you will support the bill, and we'll have quite a few proponents here in support of the bill as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll sit down and listen to the proponents and opponents.
Thank you, Senator. For proponents, make sure you state and spell your name for the record, please. And with that, we'll open up proponents in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Hoffman with Northwestern Energy. That's spelled H-O-F-F-M-A-N. I'm certainly endorse everything that Senator Fitzpatrick just said to you about the value of Colstrip and the other related issues. Northwestern Energy is a co-owner of Colstrip. We have a 30% interest in Unit 4, which translates into about 222 megawatts. Since that was rate-based in 2008, we have considered it an extremely valuable part of our portfolio. We intend to operate it as long as it is useful and economic. It provides the reliable, affordable power 24/7 when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, or even when they are. We have 2042 depreciation schedule on our piece of Colstrip, and believe it will create value for our customers until then, at least. We consider Colstrip a Montana asset, as Senator Fitzpatrick said, but also recognizing that the West Coast owners are getting extreme political and regulatory pressure. We believe it's in the interest of Montana and Montanans to have that asset owned and operated by people who have Montana's best interests in mind. So we encourage any efforts such as this bill that might encourage or facilitate continued operation of Colstrip through its useful and economic life. I will mention now, and it's in relation to the subsequent bill coming up, that Northwestern Energy initiated arbitration among the owners on February 9th. That's a process estimated time of conclusion of that, maybe 9 months. But the arbitration issue is exactly what Senator Fitzpatrick alluded to, which has to do with the ability of the owners or a majority of the owners to actually close Colstrip by not funding adequate operation and maintenance costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Any other proponents in the room?
Good morning, afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R. I'm here today on behalf of Talon, Montana. With the chair's permission, I have some handouts for the record.
Please do.
Just by way of highlight, those documents are Talon's testimony for purposes of the record, plus an economic impact statement associated with the operation of units 3 and 4, plus some recent correspondence relative to the issue that's before the committee, both with the department and the co-owners.
Mr. Taylor, can I ask you before you continue, did we get a copy of this electronically so I can provide it to members online?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. I mean, have you already?
No, I have not, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
So, members of the committee, we'll make sure and get that and put it on Teams for you. Thank you, sir.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Talon is in a bit of a unique situation relative to Colstrip. We are a 30% owner in Unit 3, but we're also, in addition to being the operator, we are the only merchant generator at Colstrip. Everybody else are utilities. So Talon is more sensitive, arguably, to Colstrip economics than any other owner because we effectively don't have a rate base to put costs associated with Colstrip into. As operator, we strive to keep Colstrip units 3 and 4 economically viable in the long term. It's critical from our standpoint that we must balance the desire to be low cost with the need to ensure the units continue to run safely, reliably, and in compliance with all Montana's laws for years to come. And that exceeds or extends beyond 2025, which is the anticipated or targeted closure date or exit date from many of the West Coast owners. Recent budget increases in units 3 and 4 are mostly driven by two factors. One is higher employee costs related to pensions and the need to effectively capture that accrued obligation by 2025. The second part of that is recruiting and making sure we are retaining capable employees to operate the plant. Those are two significant aspects associated with the ongoing costs. In addition to that, with the retirement of units 1 and 2, it's only logical that additional costs are borne necessarily by units 3 and 4 as a part of the ongoing operations of Colstrip. Coastal owners have balked at the budgets for some time now, and at least Puget has also paid under protest. We believe that this bill is important to go forward, even with the West Coast owners approving the 2021 budget the night before last. So I think it's important that we make sure in outlier years that Colstrip is operated and ran in an efficient, effective way to protect our employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent in the room, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T, representing the Montana AFL-CIO. We rise in support of Senate Bill 266 today, which seeks to balance the playing field between Montana's interests related to baseload generation, worker retention, our state economy, and tax revenue with the interests of out-of-state utilities. We believe that out-of-state utilities should not be able to unilaterally decide the future of Montana's energy generation and energy workers. But once you've stopped maintenance operations on Units 3 and 4, you've essentially assigned those units a closure date. This will also reduce the workplace safety for workers in the units leading up to closure. What this legislation seeks to do, though, is to bring the owners to the table to come up with and establish a fair and equitable solution. So we ask for a yes vote on this, and please give Montana a seat at the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent in the room, please.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is John Forkan, F-O-R-K-A-N. I'm here today representing the Montana State Building and Construction Trades Council. We rise in support of this bill. Our concern, of course, is if there was some type of independent action by one of the owners or something, the consequences to the worker's safety could be at risk, and we would never want to see that. So in support of those workers, we would ask you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next proponent in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman, committee members. Dwight Rose, R-O-S-E, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We represent utility workers. I'm just going to run a little bit more with emphasis on keeping the facility intact. There's two SJ resolutions, 3 and 10, that for small nuclear reactor and also for the carbon capture. If this facility is not in working order, it's going to be that much more work that is going to have to be done, that much more money to keep it up and running. So with that, please keep that in mind. We stand in support of 266 and ask you guys to do the same for this facility. We need it for the base load. If we lose the base load, we don't have nothing to restart Montana. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Next proponent in the room, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Luke Hoffer. That's H-O-F-F-E-R. I'm with the IBEW Local 233. I agree with all the testimonies before me, and we ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other proponents in the room? Proponents. All right, and Ms. Egerbrecht, I see there are neither, well, there's one opponent, but I don't, oh, she might be online now. Let's double check. Okay, yeah, so I don't see any proponents. So no further proponents. Let's go to opponents in the room, please.
Mr. Chair, Tom Ebzery, E-B-Z-E-R-Y, Billings attorney, and I'm here on behalf of Portland General Electric and Vistacorp. They are two of the six owners who have now been labeled West Coast owners recently. And Vista has a 15% interest in Colstrip 3 and 4 and 20% interest for Portland General Electric. We'll say at the outset, both companies greatly appreciate the Colstrip facility as faithfully served its customers in the regional electrical needs for many decades. This bill affects a complex contractual relationship amongst the six owners of Colstrips 3 and 4. This bill is asking you to intrude into that relationship, which has been governed by an owner's agreement signed 40 years ago, which specifies how disagreements must be resolved. And the agreement works. As a prime example, the co-workers or owners recently worked through the 2021 operation and maintenance budget that you've heard about to address the concerns regarding a substantial increase in operating costs over the prior years. The revised O&M budget was approved just this week, which followed the process in the owner's agreement. The bill sponsor, when he introduced this bill in this committee, in the committee in the Senate, and then he brought it forward, referring to the West Coast owners, the most inflammatory was just heard that he. It's kind of like we're having a divorce here. The West Coast operators, they're leaving the facility. They don't want to be part of it anymore for various reasons, and so be it. And then he goes about talking about walking away and trashing the facility on the way out. So take this divorce analogy. What we're doing is trashing the house and keying the car on the way out the door. This statement and analogy is blatantly false and not backed up by facts nor supported by the interaction between the owners with their obligation under the owner's agreement. None of these owners have ever missed a capital call or payment since 3 and 4 were constructed. And both of these owners were here well before the South Dakota-based Northwestern and Texas-based Talon were involved in the plant. trying to influence a legitimate disagreement between an operator and the other owners through a legislative process is just wrong. This bill sends a bad signal to businesses that may be looking to invest in Montana. The message is the legislature can meddle into your legitimate agreements and change the terms of your contracts. This will not be in the interests of Montana. The bill includes provisions that are clearly intended to impair the existing Colstrip owner's agreement. The bill, let me explain a few parts of the bill that would be challenged. The bill adds new language to the Consumer Protection Act under Title 30, Chapter 14, so it would specifically apply to Colstrip under the Consumer Act, with the effect of making the two actions explicitly an unfair or a deceptive act. A would be the failure of an owner of a jointly owned electrical generation facility in the state to fund its share of operating costs with a jointly owned electrical generating facility. That would be considered under this deal an unfair or deceptive act. And then second, conduct by one or more owners of a jointly owned electrical generation facility to bring about a permanent closure of a generating facility without containing the consent of other owners, that would be an unfair or deceptive act. This new language is to establish an alternative remedy to the one contained in the owner's agreement for Colstrip 3 and 4 that was signed in 1981 by six owners and has governed the relationship then. The ownership agreement is clear about how disagreements are to be settled, and over the years it's shown that arbitration and negotiation works. So there are several definitions that they have basically taken and placed in the statute that are different from the owner's agreement, and you'll see throughout on section 7 and 11 on operating costs, 14 to 22 on the definition of prudent utility practice. And so the intent of these is to bring an action under the Consumer Protection Act against the owners of the plant. The definition of operating cost is based on the bill's prudent utility practice that is in the agreement, but it's been altered in terms to make this fit in the statute. As co-owners of Colstrip bound to a legally enforceable contract, how could we be expected to honor the requirements of a contract in this bill, which conflicts with the agreement that we have with other owners of the plant? In addition, the provision making it an unlawful trade practice to vote to close with less than 100% of the owners is arguably a violation of the contracts clause. The proposed fines and violations are punitive and unnecessary, and the plan meets and exceeds state and federal regulatory requirements, so penalties do not seem appropriate. I want to make a mention about safety. That, I believe, was brought up in the Senate hearing. I do not believe safety is an issue, and that is a responsibility of the owners, but through the operator of the plant. The Montana legislature has a short-term time to enact legislation on very important matters, and Senate Bill 255 would ask you to be a legislative referee in private contractual matters. If it happens under this bill, a significant number of businesses could be subject to similar bills in the future. My clients have been good corporate citizens in Colstrip, Rosebud County, and the state of Montana, and no owner has announced that he is leaving the plant, let alone keying the car. So we urge that you not move forward with this punitive bill and let the owners work out their disagreements. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The next opponent in the room, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Lewis. Last name is spelled L-E-W-I-S. I'm a resident of Helena, and I represent Puget Sound Energy in opposition to Senate Bill 266. My colleague and fellow lobbyist for Puget Sound Energy, Mark Baker, is in the room today, and happy to have him here as well. As you may know, Puget Sound Energy is a regulated electric and natural gas utility located in the state of Washington. Puget co-owned units 1 and 2 with Talon and has 25% interest in both units 3 and 4. Puget helped build Colstrip back in the day in the 1970s and the 1980s. For the last half century, over five decades, we've been an important partner of the state of Montana and a responsible corporate citizen. We're very proud to have contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to the state budget over the last 50 years. So over the course of the last several decades, we continue to contribute to the state economy, the local economy, regional economies, and we will continue to do so for decades and decades to come. We are the first and only owner to have contributed $10 million to the Colstrip Community Transition Fund, and we actively participated in the Colstrip Community Impact Advisory Group, which was a group that convened to talk about how the Puget's $10 million should be invested or spent in the community. To date, I don't believe any of those dollars have been spent. In addition, we have set aside all necessary funding for the decommissioning and remediation work required by the Federal Administrative Order of Consent and the State Montana Department of Environmental Quality. It's important to note that not every owner can say that they have banked money for cleanup, decommissioning, and remediation. Puget is just one of six Colstrip owners. Five other major utilities co-own Colstrip, and all five of those owners are out of state. Contrary to what you may have heard, Puget is absolutely not leaving Montana, nor are we at risk of jumping ship or breaking plates. Quite the contrary, Puget Sound Energy plans to stay and invest in Montana. Like I said, we've been here for over 50 years. We continue to invest. We've contributed an extra $10 million just for the community. We've banked a lot of substantial funding for decommissioning and remediation, and we continue to invest in the great state of Montana. Efforts to invest in Montana are pending as we speak. The city of Colstrip and the state of Montana have been our partners for over 50 years, not just the men and women who work at the plant, but their families, friends, and neighbors too. We are invested in their future successes and look forward to continuing working together in a good faith effort. Specific to this bill, as Mr. Ebsery stated, Senate Bill 266 would have both legal and practical implications if it were passed and signed into law. We agree with all points offered by Mr. Ebsery. Senate Bill 266 is absolutely not necessary. Puget Sound Energy and the Pacific Northwest owners are paying their bills. They're paying their bills on time. We've always paid our bills. And just recently, we took steps yesterday, or if not the day before, to approve the revised budget for 2021. So practically speaking, if this bill passes, the utility will likely find itself in protracted, prolonged litigation with the state of Montana and unable to engage in discussions outside of the court. This bill will have the effect of state legislation actually adding time, complexity, uncertainty, and other unintended consequences that will ultimately be unproductive for Colstrip. This is not the ending that we had envisioned for the community that has been our partner for over five decades, and we would respectfully ask that you table this bill. If you have any questions regarding statements offered by some of the proponents, I'd be happy to answer those, and we'll be in the room if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any opponents in the room, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Charles Deno, spelled D-E-N-O-W-H, here today on behalf of Rocky Mountain Power. Rocky Mountain Power is a utility headquartered in Salt Lake City. We serve customers primarily in Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. We are 10% owners in units 3 and 4 and have a wind farm near Pryor, Montana. And I just want to echo what you've heard today from some of the other opponents. We feel that we've been good corporate citizens in the state of Montana since the beginning of Colstrip. We like doing business in Montana, and we're interested in investing here in other projects. But I think it sends a bad message to people looking to invest in Montana, to start a business here, to create jobs here, if we're going to have the state begin to interfere in contractual agreements. So for that reason, I would ask you to table the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there any other opponents in the room? Oh my gosh.
Good afternoon, Representative Chairman Skies. My name is Monica Tranel, T-R-A-N-E-L. I'm a citizen of Montana and a proud elementary school attendee of Ashland Public School in St. LaBrae. I have two handouts I'd like to deliver, if I may, Representative Skies.
Please do. And then, Ms. Tranel, when you come back to the microphone, make sure if we don't have an electronic copy submitted, make sure we get that to our staff so we can make sure it's online for the folks that are participating virtually. If you would, please. So, since you're a school teacher, is this homework?
Representative Skies, Chair Skies, I'm not a school teacher. I was a student at St. LaBrae and Ashland Public School, so I know the country well and love it. What I have handed out today, which I would like marked and included in the record for both Senate Bill 266 and the next one you're about to hear, 265, is the owner-operator agreement for Colstrip, and it is also the administrative order on consent that was signed recently by Northwestern. I figure as long as the government is going to start rewriting contracts, you may as well have the contract in front of you that you're about to rewrite. Make no mistake about it, I agree completely with Senator Steve Fitzpatrick on one thing. This is extremely straightforward. This is a plain and simple government takeover of private business. It's nothing else. And we have a word for that. We call that communism. With these two bills, Northwestern and Senator Fitzpatrick are putting Russia on the run for how to operate a communist society. This was written and entered into in 1981. 39 years and 11 months ago, it was signed on May 6th of 1981. It was amended in 1991, and it was amended a second time in 1998. All of the corporations that are a party to this are out-of-state corporations. They are multi-billion dollar businesses. You've heard the testimony of the partners here. They've been good stewards of Montana. They've been good investors. And the jobs that we have, that our unions are fighting for, are here because of the investment that was made by this contract. If you rewrite it now, if you take over private investments, if you function as a communist state, these private businesses are going to go to Wyoming, to Idaho. And they are going there. They don't need to do business with a communist state at risk of having their contracts rewritten and taken over. This is the government picking winners and losers. We have a 30% owner who has $300 million that it still has to get paid. Northwestern Energy has $300 million remaining in this plant to be paid by Montanans. They want their money. That's it. They have a 30% owner. They're a 30% owner. They're asking the government to make them 100% control. That's wrong. These are all big boys who can afford good lawyers. And they can sit down at the table and hammer this out and work through it. And if Northwestern has a problem with this, they should have been thinking about that 12 years ago, 10 years ago. Not coming to you begging for your help and intervention and making our state into a communist sandbox. that benefits only Northwestern. You're putting Montanans
Ms. Trunell, please,
on the hook.
Please, I understand that you're impassioned on this issue. That's totally cool. And I understand communism is a catchphrase for many Republicans on this committee. But please, let's stay to the bill. Just stay to the facts. Please try not to add those emotional phrases. All it's going to do is upset a bunch of people. It's going to lead to a whole bunch of problems. Can we just stay to your objections to the bill? That should be awesome.
Very good, Representative Chairman Skies. Happy to do so.
Thank you.
And happy to answer questions as well, too. To your point, for specific points in the bill, with respect to line 6A, if you look at that, as you define prudent utility practices, ask yourselves, with the economic retreat from coal right now, Blackstone getting out of coal because it's uneconomic, Blackstone is Northwestern's largest single investor, what is a prudent utility practice? New section 2.1A, who determines its share? Who makes that determination? You all? We're going to come back to you and say, hey, we don't really know what its share is. Do we go to the contract that we're negating? Serious problems. But most chilling to me, as a lawyer who has litigated this contract for the Montana Consumer Council on behalf of Montana consumers, most chilling to me is new section 2A. The language in there, when the government has reason to believe that a person is about to do something, they get to bring an action. Where else can the government bring an action against you for what you're about to do? That's thought police. That is chilling. It's terrifying. I'm an attorney. I work with renewable energy clients. I know that there are serious investors out there looking to bring billions of dollars to Montana. They won't come here. If they enter into good faith contracts, investing in Montana, knowing that you're going to rewrite them, it won't happen. Think about the consequences to Montana. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you, Chairman Skies.
Thank you. Are there any other opponents in the room? All right, we will go to Ann Hedges from the MEIC online.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ann Hedges with Montana Environmental Information Center. We also oppose this bill for some of the reasons that have been stated in a couple more. This bill isn't about plant safety. Those safety costs get paid by the owners. If they didn't, those owners would be liable for injuries to workers. And if nothing else, these owners are the most risk-averse corporations in America. They just aren't interested in any type of risk, and not paying for safety measures increases risk. There's no doubt about that. So I just don't think there's anything about this bill that has to do with safety. These owners have been paying for maintenance, and one of the reasons we know that is that Unit 4 was down in the fall of 2020 for 2 months for overhaul, for maintenance work. That's not anything that they take lightly. It is something that they do periodically, but taking a plant down for 2 months to do work on it is a significant investment. And despite that, the plant still broke down, Unit 4 did, in the middle of February, right after the cold snap, because of boiler tube leaks and economizer tube leaks, according to Mr. Hoffman's memo to the Business and Labor Committee in the Senate. So we know that the plant has had investments in it very recently, and significant investments. What this bill does, though, it creates a really chilling effect on future joint ventures in Montana between in-state and out-of-state investors. I think of facilities like the Gordon Butte Pumped Hydro Project, 400 megawatt pumped hydro project, a really gold standard of a project. They're looking for investors. They're looking for out-of-state investors. And when you bring a bill like this, you make those investors run the other direction. They are also, the same company is proposing something similar in Wyoming. If I were an investor, I'd go to Wyoming if you have a bill like this. Because you have this bizarre insertion of the Montana Attorney General in management decisions, such as what is prudent. And if Montana tries to force the continued operation of a facility and determine what is prudent outside the regular regulatory structure, what will happen is Montana will become a potentially liable party if this place ever becomes a Superfund site, which I'm telling you is not out of the realm of possibility. Montana doesn't want to be an operator or an owner or somebody who had some control over the future operation of this plant. I would suggest that you tread very, very lightly on such a concept, which is what this bill introduces. And then one of the biggest concerns I have with this bill is, again, on page 3, line 4 through 6, that were just pointed out, whenever the department has reason to believe that a person is using, has used, or is about to knowingly use any method, act, or practice provided in subsection 1, then they're liable. That is really stunning language. It's incredibly broad. And if I were a business thinking of doing business in Montana in the utility sector, I would be really nervous when I saw language like that, because it's easy to amend language in the law to just include one more person and include one more person. I think this bill is incredibly intrusive, and it is going to have a chilling effect on future investments. And it makes me wonder about the big wind farm that is proposed just north of Colstrip, 700 megawatts, in which we're still waiting for a buyer of that project to come forward. And it's bills like this that send those investors elsewhere. I would really like to see that wind farm be developed. I'd like to see a lot more wind farms be developed, a lot more investment in the state of Montana, and this bill sends investments elsewhere. So with that, we urge you to do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hedges. I believe if there's no other opponents in the room, we will now go to informational witnesses. There's none online. Any informational witnesses in the room? All right, seeing none, let's go to questions from the committee. Representative Kazmaier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Mark Taylor.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kazmaier.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, is this bill just for Colstrip, or is it going to take other properties in Montana like Hardin?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kazmaier, for the record, I also represent the Hardin Generating Station, which is owned by Beowulf, and this bill would apply to them just the same as it would to Colstrip. So, as it was written, I know I heard one of the objections from one of the bill opponents that this was only applied to Colstrip. It applies to all coal generating facilities. That includes Hardin and others. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question, maybe for Ms. Trunell.
Ms. Trunell?
Chairman Skies.
Chairman Skies, Ms. Trunell, my question goes to the fact that it's retroactive as well as interfering with contracts, and I'm wanting to bring it a little bit closer to home. Wouldn't this be an unconstitutional bill in that sense, that it's retroactively affecting contracts?
Chairman Skies, Representative Olson, members of the committee, thank you very much for the question. It is, in fact, an unconstitutional takings and subject to litigation on that ground. More troubling and really to be seriously taken into account by this committee in voting on this bill is the pairing of this with Senate Bill 260, which you passed last week, I understand. And what that bill does, paired with this one, would subject Montana citizens to incredible financial obligations if the owners who are being chased out of Montana by this bill were to claim their right that their private property has been taken by the government, which 266 does, And the value of that is no less than $2 billion. Under Senate Bill 260, which you all passed, Montanans are on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars. That obligation is on our shoulders now, if you pass this bill. So it's incredibly troublesome. Appreciate the question. Thank you, Representative Olson. Thank you, Chairman Skies.
Follow up, though, Ms.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, is that okay?
Of course, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Trunell, so we see a lot of bills trying to address the potential closure of Colstrip and the consequences of that potential closure at some time in the future. And these ones, and we're trying to figure out as legislators how this is not going to continually cost all of us as ratepayers an awful lot of money. But in this situation, I see what you're saying about how it's not only going to be more expensive, we're going to lose on all fronts with a bill like this, it seems to me. But my question for you is, isn't there an alternative? If Northwest Energy feels like it's being treated unfairly by its contractual partners, isn't there other recourse for a partner to a contract to seek damages or redress if they feel like they're being treated unfairly? And bills aren't getting paid, for example.
Thank you, Chairman Skies, Representative Olson, members of the committee. Yes, thank you for the question, and that is exactly the reason why I wanted the contract itself introduced into the record and made part of this hearing, because that contract does have explicit provisions, and I believe you heard the other owners testify, and I would defer perhaps to Puget and some of the other owners to talk about the historical nature of that. There are specific provisions for how you work out a disagreement. It's a contract. That's what private contracting is. And when government takes over private contracts, apologies, Representative Skies, but that is communism. It's not the purview of the government to fix problems that these private entities and private businesses have entered into. That's not your job. The contract that they agreed to, that they entered into, has provisions for off-ramps. They can get out, and they can get out under the terms of their agreed-upon commitments. They agreed to those, and they can exit according to the same agreement they got in on. And make no mistake about this bill. This isn't a save Colstrip.
Ms. Trunell, let's stay to the question you're asked, please. I'm not going to allow a bunch of time at the microphone to go on and on.
Thank you, Chairman Skies and Representative Olson. The first sentence of Representative Olson's question was, we're seeing a lot of bills about saving Colstrip.
Yes, ma'am, so but it's my interpretation as to what we'll allow at the podium.
Okay, I wanted to speak to that point, if I may.
Have you not answered a question already? I think you have.
That's certainly up to Representative Olson.
I agree. Representative Olson.
Well, I would like, I guess I have a two-part question for a quick follow-up, which is for her to continue what she's saying there, but also to answer the question generally. How do we as legislators protect ratepayers in all of these discussions? As you mentioned, we have companies who have a lot of money that they pay dividend holders and they make profits. How do we protect ratepayers in these situations?
Chairman Skies, Representative Olson, members of the committee, protecting ratepayers is really the job of the Public Service Commission, and that's what they do in a very granular hearing. The utilities go to the Public Service Commission and they get a rate, and this Unit 4 was built in the 1980s, went online in 1985, was never in rate base until 2008. For the first time, it was put in rate base. The Consumer Council valued the net book value of the plant in 2008 was $37 million. Northwestern convinced the Public Service Commission it was actually worth $404 million. We're still paying on that today. We owe about $300 million on that. The best way to protect ratepayers is to ensure that when this plant closes, the stranded cost of this asset is not saddled on the backs of Montana ratepayers, but is borne by management and shareholders. They are the people who have the information, who make the decisions, and who bear the reward, the monetary reward, and the risk of these kinds of things that happen. The plant's going to close. We protect the ratepayers by making management and shareholders bear their share of the risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Trunell. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for a point of clarification, Senate Bill 260 is passed the Senate, and it's in House Business and Labor. We did not pass that. You don't need to come back. That was
Thank
just
you.
My statement.
Thank you.
Just making sure the House Energy has not seen that bill. That bill's not even in House Energy. And if that bill makes it past Business and Labor, maybe then these individual members will see that bill on the floor. So now let's go to Vice Chair Heyman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Esbury.
Mr. Esbury. I think it's actually Ebsery, isn't it?
Ebsery. Yes. Sorry, God. Second time I've done it.
Two in a row. Mr. Chair, Representative Heyman.
Mr. Ebsery. So, a couple of things here. Section 2, could you do a little bit of a deep dive in what that section means and tie it in maybe with the agreement that you just made, all the co-owners agreed to pay $85 million on base operation costs. And could you talk about that? And I understand that's a 25% increase from last time. Excuse me. Could you just give us a little bit of information, a little bit of a deep dive in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heyman, I think you're talking about Section 2 of the ownership agreement, and and then you suggested you put some numbers out in terms of the latest maintenance operated and maintenance agreement. Is that correct? And would like a little more information
that's
on
correct.
That.
Yeah.
Okay. From what I know is that I think it was the initial budget process usually begins in the fall for the following year. Budget proposal initiated by Talon at that time, it may have been like a 25% increase. They continued to negotiate. I believe that number is lower, and all the parties, to my knowledge, at least the so-called West Coast utilities, they have affirmed, they have agreed to the 2021 budget, and that is a fairly significant increase. But I think at that time they asked that take a better look at these costs and see if we can bring them back down to what the facilities that they operate in other states, and that's what I know. And as far as I know, that this and the capital budget was already approved, so that's where we stand.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up,
Mr. Ebsbury. So I'm wondering, looking at the new section on page 2, section 2, it talks about jointly owned electrical generation facilities. Can you talk about what that section would do to future negotiations with the other co-owners?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Heyman, I I'm looking at this, and I think in our testimony we've made it pretty clear, is that we have been bound since 81 with that operating agreement, which is now been passed out. They've lived with that, and I guess I don't understand. This obviously, this provision, this section, certainly wouldn't enhance, I don't think, any the owners to, I'm not sure what you want said there, but they would be joined together in this thing.
Point of clarification, Representative?
Yes. What I'm trying to get at is currently you had a negotiation that involved $85 million. For maintenance and operations. It's somewhere around that figure. It was definitely an increase from last time. What protects you? How is this section? I'm concerned that you're not in charge of this estimate, that this comes mostly from Talon, who determines what the costs are gonna be. And does this put you, this section, put you in harm's way in a way that if you don't agree with the cost increase for operations, does this put you in a bad situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heyman, just a little background. I think I mentioned that Talon is the operator, and under the agreement, they are the ones that propose the budget. They are the right people to put that together because they are hands-on at the plant. They put a proposal together, and then it goes to the owners, and there is a typical negotiation that's provided for under the agreement. If they disagree, and then you keep coming back, and I think that's what happened here. They went from whatever you say percentage, and I don't know, the dollar figure was the first I've heard you have, but I have not heard before what the total dollar figure was, but they reached some point. If they get an impasse, there's provisions under the agreement that you see there that could triggers our, that one party can trigger arbitration. Our point is sections like this would impair that ability to do that. So that may be the answer you were looking for. The answer is that negotiation through an through arbitration is a last resort. And if it's unsuccessful, you go to arbitration. Under this provision, you could be cited for an Unfair Trade Practice Act, and it alters the ability to operate that agreement.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Custer.
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Custer.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Taylor, since your client is Talon and they operate the plant, could you explain to these folks why it's prudent that they would want their budget to be as low as possible since they're a merchant generator, and what the difference is between that and the other?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative Custer, thanks for the question. So to be clear, for the record, Talon is a merchant operator, which makes them incredibly unique in their role as applied to Colstrip. They don't have a guaranteed rate base with which they get to recover their costs associated with the operation. They are literally bare from a risk reward standpoint. They bear 100% of their risk each and every year with their dollar investments associated with Colstrip. Nobody else from an ownership group standpoint has that risk exposure. So obviously, because of the risk exposure, nobody from an ownership group standpoint has more to lose relative to the financial viability and operational financial exposure associated with Colstrip. We believe that we've been a very good operator of Colstrip. We believe we've worked with the ownership group to develop a budget year after year that meets the ongoing operational needs as well as protecting the safety of our workers. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I have one more follow-up?
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Taylor, could you explain when the budget's due, when it's usually signed, and when it got finally signed this year, and so we can kind of see why we're in the situation with maybe this legislation?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Custer, we have to present a budget by September 1 to the co-owners for review. Typically, we try to resolve that in the November time frame. Occasionally, it has slipped to the end of the year. This is the very first year that I'm aware of. There's others that may have a different historical perspective, but this is the first year that the budget was not approved by January 1. My understanding is, based on communications with Talon leadership, an agreement was reached with all the owners to support the budget Monday evening.
Thank you.
Representative Kazmaier.
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Ebsery.
Mr. Ebsery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kazmaier.
Mr. Ebsery, with this last little bit of information, what has changed to all of a sudden pass the budget? Was there some new information, or what is the sudden change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kazmaier, I'm not sure, but I know that in spite of what's going on in the legislature, they have operating committees that have been meeting directly, and it's just been it took a longer term process to get the budget lowered and covered, and the time. I don't know if there was any coincidence with this bill. I think it was going on since, as Mr. Taylor said, since October, November, and it apparently fell together this week.
Thank you, Mr. Ebsery. Thank you, Chairman.
Vice Chair Zolnikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Lewis, please.
Ms. Lewis.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lewis. This is kind of a piggyback off of Rep. Kazmaier's earlier question about what other plants this would affect. And I'm reading here that it only affects jointly owned, and I guess I'm just wanted some clarification if there are other jointly owned projects of this size in Montana or that this would apply to.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Zolnikoff, that's a really good question, and I am not sure whether the Hardin plant is jointly owned or not. I do not represent the Hardin plant, but Mr. Taylor, who lobbies for Talon and the Hardin plant, is here and may be able to answer that question.
Would you like to redirect that question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I confused my
That's
people.
Quite all right. Mr. Taylor, do you need the question restated, or do you got it?
Mr. Chairman, I think I got this one. Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Zolnikoff, relative to the Hardin plant, it's ironically, it's an LLC subsidiary of Beowulf called Rocky Mountain Power, not the same Rocky Mountain Power associated with Colstrip. And within that subsidiary, there's a variety of ownership structures. We recently partnered with, as you may have seen in the press, the Bighorn Data Hub. So we're actively always looking for joint ventures and those sorts of things, and this bill would apply to those situations as well.
Thank you.
Representative Durham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Hoffman, please.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Durham.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hoffman, as you know, this isn't my skill set, and so I guess the numbers aren't quite adding up to me. If you could help me get a perspective of the ownership of Colstrip number 3 and number 4, because by my math, if I understand it right, we're up to maybe 55% on number 4 and less than that on number 3.
You're talking about, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Durham, you're asking about overall ownership of the plant?
Point of clarification?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman. Yeah, if you could just briefly explain that, and then my seatmate provided a good
cheat sheet.
Yeah, between the two, Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, between the two, what we call the big units, Unit 3 and Unit 4, which are 740 megawatts net each, Puget Sound Energy owns 25% of that total. Portland General has 20% of the total, Avista 15%, Northwestern Energy 15%, Talon, Montana 15%, and Pacific Core 10%. Of course, as an example, Northwestern Energy's 15% of both units is represented by its 30% ownership of one of them.
Mr. Chair, follow up. And again, Mr. Hoffman, if you could kind of help me understand. So we heard that Rocky Mountain Power owns 10% in units 3 and number 4. Do they have a different name, or am I missing something?
Rocky Mountain, Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, Rocky Mountain Power is affiliated with Pacific Core, which is one of the utilities on the West Coast, and a 10% owner.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up different concern. And so ultimately, I guess all I care about is that we have electricity for Montana citizens. And so could you provide kind of a overall picture of what percentage of this electricity generated from Colstrips 3 and 4 comes to Montana and how much is exported?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, obviously the West Coast owners' energy goes to the West Coast or into their service territories for the most part. Northwestern Energy's 222 megawatts stays within Montana. Again, for the most part, there may be times when there's excess power, the wind is blowing and there's excess wind power, and some of that could be sold outside. But typically that 222 megawatts is used to serve as baseload power for our portfolio. And then Talon, Montana, I can't really speak for, but they are a merchant, so they sell that to wholesale customers.
Follow-up? Mr. Chair, follow-up. And so you did say obviously, but obviously it's not as obvious as it should be to me. So essentially, the percentages that we've discussed also reflect the percentages of the power distributed. Is that a fair general statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, I'm not quite sure what you mean by distributed. If you mean transported to the end-use customer, yes.
Is that what you meant, Representative Durham?
In general, and then again,
follow-up?
Mr. Chair, to demonstrate how little I perhaps understand on this issue, it sounds to me like Montana consumers, being Northwestern customers, essentially receive 30% of Colstrip Unit Number 4. Is that even close to a fair statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, yes, that's very close.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman.
Sounds like you understand it quite well, sir.
Indeed.
Give me more time and I'll demonstrate that I don't.
If there's no further questions from the committee, I have a couple. Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a question to Ms. Trunnell.
Ms. Trunnell.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Trunnell, you mentioned that the plant, a couple times, that the plant was closing, correct?
I think that's an accurate assessment, Chairman Skies, Representative Phelan. I did make that statement.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up, please. Mr. Chair, when do you believe that the plant is going to close?
Chairman Skies, Representative Phelan, members of the committee, the depreciation schedule for the other owners of Colstrip is 2027. Under the administrative order of consent, which was one of the documents that I handed out to you, shows that the ash ponds, the way that the coal ash is stored, has to change in 2022, and that will significantly change the costs of production of electricity from Colstrip. So just on an economic basis alone, 2022 will be a significant driver of what the costs are, with the 2027 termination date for other plants. I certainly think it would be reasonable to be looking at within the next few years. Coal is uneconomic, Northwestern's largest investor, has publicly said it's getting out of coal for economic reasons. So those are, you know, that information is available publicly. I'm happy to get you more support for that information, but I think just reading the facts is pretty, the writing's on the wall, and Montana would be well served to plan and prepare and use our incredible natural resources, including wind and hydro and solar, to our best interests. Coal has been an incredible natural resource for Montana, and I grew up in that country, Representative Chairman Skies, Representative Phelan. So it has served us well. And like all things, its time is closing, and we're moving on to new things. And that's what Montana does. We embrace the future. We're a can-do people. We've got tremendous resources that we can use, and we're best served to use those resources and make money off of the resources that are the future, and not stick our heads in the sand and bury our people with billions of dollars of debt for nothing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
I got a follow up from Mr. Ebsery.
Mr. Ebsery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan.
Yes, Mr. Ebsery, Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Ebsery. So are you in concurrent with what Ms. Trunell just said, that you are wanting to get out by 2022 or 5 or whatever? There's so many dates going or years going. I don't know which one's which.
Me too. Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, no, I'm not in agreement with that. We have not, neither company has announced a departure date at all. We have depreciation schedules, but that the purpose of those is to start banking credit for remediation purposes. Avista and Puget they cannot take after July 1st, 2025, or maybe it's December 31st, they cannot take fossil fuel power from whatever. So that can't go in their rate base after that date. But in terms of actually setting a date when to leave and whether or not that would affect the ultimate 3 and 4 closure, don't think so. But maybe coal is not economic. It's very, very possible now that they're coming, but I would never agree with that and go with it. And clearly no date has been scheduled. Is that helpful?
Mr. Chair, yeah, it is helpful. But help me out. I'm kind of like Representative Durham here. What is remediation? What do you mean by remediation? Help me out there, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, remediation is cleaning up. It's cleaning up the facility. They have been there since, in case of Puget and Talon or at Montana Power in 1975. They've been there since then. The others have been there since 85, 86. It's basically cleaning up the facility to where it was before 1975. And that's going to take sometimes as long as 30 years to do. And it's going to cost millions of dollars. And that's so these utilities aren't going anywhere. They're going to be on the job cleaning up or involved in what we call the remediation plan and fulfillment of the AOC. Administrative order of consent. So that's remediation. Maybe there are better terms, but it's just think of cleaning up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Let's go to Representative Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Ebsery, please.
Mr. Ebsery, you're awful popular today, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Ebsery. I have a question. Mr. Taylor previously spoke describing automatic rate recovery for all costs of coal strip, and I'm wondering if this is accurate for the other owners. I'm wondering if their utility commission scrutinized these costs in the same way, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sullivan, they may, excuse me, they may have rate recovery, but that they have to go through a proceeding, usually a rate case, in which they can get additional costs passed on. And it's been very clear to both of, most of the utilities that the commissions are watching. They're looking at the expenses that have been incurred at Colstrip, and they're looking at some of the other entities that they regulate. And they may get cost recovery, but maybe not the full cost that they would like to get. So it's no layup. It's a procedure that they are required to go through, especially, and I'm sure that this budget will probably be scrutinized by the Washington Utility Commission much more than it has been in the past. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Durham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Trunnell, please.
Ms. Trunnell. And Ms. Trunnell, please try to focus on staying on topic of what's asked of you, please. I know it's hard to resist a microphone and an audience, but please try to stay to the answer that's asked.
Do my best, Representative Chairman Skies, and I'm sure you'll help me.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just a little grace. I'm on this. You stop me if so be it. Ms. Trunnell, so you used the term Barry in the last discussion with Representative Phelan, and it was at that time it occurred to me that I didn't get all the documents that you sent out or that you passed around. Could you, in a minute or so, discuss what documents I'm supposed to have? Because I have two at this point, and then maybe a brief overview of what each document would reflect to me.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairman Skies, Representative Terman, and members of the committee. I believe I handed out to you, and you should have both of them. If you don't, I'm happy to make sure you do. One of the documents on the top, it says Michael J. Barnes Exhibits. That is the owner-operator agreement itself with the two amendments from 1991 and 1998. It was signed again in May 6, 1981. So you have the actual contract itself. So for all questions about what the contract does, how the disputes are resolved, all of that, that's in that contract. So you have that. And Chairman Skies, are exhibits actually marked in the record? I want to make sure these are both in this record and in 265.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. So that would be, you know, the contract itself. And then the second document I handed out, Mr. Ebsery was actually talking about it in his last statements, is the administrative order on consent. And that's available from the Montana DEQ. It's a public document as well. And that was entered into and addresses obviously the information that was being discussed and the questions that you have about liability and costs and cleanup and the June of 2022 date that Representative Fallon was questioning and interested in. So those show liabilities, contract terms, and that is, those two documents are very much the subject of these bills that you're considering. So I thought you should have them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Trunnell, for explaining your exhibits.
Thank you, and I hope I stayed on track.
Perfect.
Chairman Skies.
Perfect. Vice Chair Zolnikov.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor, please.
Senator.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, could you just give a little bit of background on what kind of led to the creation of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair. These bills were the product of some discussions that we started to have with Senator Ankeny, Senator Small. They were very concerned at the time that the refusal by the West Coast operators to participate in the budget-making process was ultimately going to lead to the closure of the plant. And I think that fear was borne out over time. There was a letter, and we'll get it for you, where Northwestern Energy more or less made that assertion when they invoked their arbitration clause. But that's really the background of these two bills, where they came from.
Thank you.
Representative Phelan.
Thanks, Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask one question to Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, I was wondering who owns units 1 and 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, Talon and Puget Sound are 50-50 owners in those two units.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. So how many, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, how many megawatts does 1 and 2 produce at this time? Do they produce as much as 3 and 4?
Point of clarification, Representative, 1 and 2 have been shut down.
Oh.
We could talk about that offline if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We could also ask Ms. Hedges about that. She'd love to talk to you on that one. Representative Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask a question of Mr. Rose, please.
Mr. Rose.
Chairman, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, we've heard a lot of talk about the corporations and how it affects out-of-state, all these out-of-state owners and all of that sort of thing. And I'm concerned about the workers. How does, and we've heard 22, 25, 27. So I just chose you out of the three, people here representing the people. What will this mean for the workers that work there on number 3 and number 4?
Representative, just like anything else.
Through the chair, please, sir.
I'm sorry. Chairman, Representative Binkley, just like anything else, if there's no certainty on what's going to happen, how do you go about life? You know, is it going to be 2025? Is it going to be 2040? Like I mentioned a little bit earlier, with the SJ3 and 10, if we can get the small nuclear reactors or if we can get the carbon capture to come in and retrofit the coal generating units, we need something. There's nothing to replace the baseload right now. So those workers that are working there, me personally, if I was there, I probably would be looking for something else. Because if the reality is 2025, you know, that's coming up real quick. So you do have to make a decision on what you're going to do. Do you stick around there or do you cut and run and go someplace else? So I would boil it down to very much uncertainty.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Durham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brief question for Mr. Deneau.
Mr. Deneau.
Didn't want to leave anybody out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Deneau, so you've heard the discussion and the term remediation came up, and I guess I just kind of add some backstory, a perception that was created within me at the last session, and it almost felt like Colstrip was more of a liability than an asset, and from the Rocky Mountain Power perspective and the remediation considerations, is Colstrip still an asset or a liability, or could you just maybe discuss your perspective on that for a minute or so?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and Representative Durham, we do view Colstrip as an asset. We get about 150 megawatts from Colstrip today, and count that as a valuable portion of our baseload power. All told, we've got 6 coal plants, including Colstrip, throughout the West. And, you know, I would say that Rocky Mountain Power is committed to coal. I think the furthest out into the future that we've got a coal plant operating, or planned to operate, is 2041. You know, Rocky Mountain Power very much views Colstrip as an asset right now.
Thank you for your expertise.
Vice Chair Heyman, did you have another question?
I did, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a question of Ms. Hedges.
Ms. Hedges.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heyman, I thought I was going to get out without having to answer anything.
We're not letting you off that easy. So to follow up on Chair Ski's statement about the closure of coal strip units 1 and 2, could you share some information about that?
Hang on one second. Vice Chair Heyman, I know that I brought that in by saying that to Representative Phelan, but that's an offline conversation. 1 and 2 is not in this bill. We are already an hour and a half on this one, and we have another really contentious one. Can we please stay to this bill? I would love to engage you and Representative Phelan, and we'll bring Ms. Edges in on that discussion if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate what you're saying. Can I just ask one last follow-up question, not to Ms. Hedges, but to Mr. Taylor?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heyman.
I'm somewhat familiar with the community transition funding. I know we've heard that Puget has put $10 million into that. I know that Avista has promised $3 million. Can you tell me about Talon's commitment to this transition funding, and what is the transition funding?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamlin, what I can tell you is that Talon is committed to a long-term viability and sustainability of Colstrip. That includes beyond the what you heard in terms of the December 2025 date for purposes of operating Colstrip. Our goal and desire has been and will continue to be to operate the plant so long as it's economically viable. We have not participated in that fund, in part because we're making investments and we want to continue to make investments in Colstrip for the long haul. Relative to, and Northwestern can talk about their perspective on the long-term viability of Colstrip, but I believe in their rate case, they identified operating Colstrip until 2042. We believe Colstrip has a long life cycle, and we want to participate in that as a part of our economic investment. And we too believe that Colstrip is an asset. Our CEO has stated as much in public forums here in Montana, and that's where we're going to put our money versus a community fund to effectively look at an exit strategy.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Seeing no further questions, so that means that after I ask my questions, nobody else is going to ask questions. So if you want to ask a question, please do it now, because as the chair, I'm not going to recognize any more questions, and we're going to go to close. Vice Chair Zolnikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this quick. Question for Ms. Lewis, please.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lewis, hopefully we don't have to redirect this one. My bad. Ms. Lewis, so based on my question earlier to how this legislation sort of came about, and there was the talk of the West Coast owners not participating in budget making, we've kind of spoken to that, but I'm curious, as we heard in testimony today, a budget was passed or approved or whatever you call it day or two ago. Was there like negotiation? Is that the original budget? Is it a revised budget? I guess I'm just curious, you know, I'm just curious about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, thank you very much for the question. It's a very good question. I can let you know that this 2021 budget is not the first time that a budget has been delayed. Prior to 2021, the Pacific Northwest owners have actually opposed capital and O&M budgets in the past. All budgets proposed by Talon, the operator, are always carefully scrutinized by each owner to ensure that customers' monies are spent appropriately. And for this particular budget, it's my understanding that there was a lot of back and forth between the six owners, Talon as owner operator. regarding the documentation or justification for such a dramatic cost increase. It's my understanding that the budget for last year was in the $70 million range. The owners are hopeful that the budget for 2021 can come down and be in more of the $85 million range for the year. It's difficult to agree to pay that much money without documentation that we can take to our regulators. Of the six owners, five of them are regulated and do have to answer to a commission, and whether it be in Oregon or Idaho or Washington State, we do have to respond to our regulatory agencies and provide justification for all costs. And so without the proper documentation, it was very difficult for the owners to sign on to an operating and maintenance budget for the year without proper justification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up.
Of course.
For Ms. Lewis again, Mr. Chair. So listening to this hearing, I'm understanding the concerns of both parties. I guess my question is, if Puget Sound Energy did want to exit Colstrip, what would be that process?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, that's a very good question, and I would say that the answer to that question is going to be arbitrated, and that arbitration was initiated by Northwestern Energy, and so the arbitration will determine whether an owner like Puget and other owners can combined opt out of the Colstrip generating facility, so to say, and potentially invest in other resources in the state, whether we can make that decision as an individual owner or whether all owners need to come to a consensus agreement for that decision to take place. And so that is one of the two questions that I believe will be answered during the arbitration process that was instigated by Northwestern Energy.
Thank you.
Follow up?
One quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. So if one of the six owners wanted to sell their shares of Colstrip for whatever reason, that sale would have to be unanimously approved. Is that what I'm understanding?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, thank you for clarifying that question. So it's my understanding that individual owners of Colstrip can actually communicate amongst themselves to come up with private sector solutions to keep the plant operating beyond its useful life, whether that be 2025 or 2042. And so there's no state legislation is needed to allow the owners to talk amongst themselves to come up with such a solution. However, if the solution requires regulatory approval or legislative approval, if there's a cost component and somebody brings forward legislation, that enters the legislature into the private sector conversations. If the discussions that are ongoing require any sort of regulatory approval in Montana or another state, then the regulators get involved. So it really depends on the nature of what's being discussed, but it's my understanding that there's nothing preventing the owners from working together to come forward with a private sector solution to sell a portion of the plant to another owner or to give a portion of the plant to another owner.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank
Excellent.
You.
Members of the committee, any other questions? Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be for Mr. Ebsery again, please.
Mr. Ebsery, you're getting your cardio for today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ebsery, just one question I have. If you pull out a Colstrip because you don't want natural resource power, can't you send that power to some other customer that would welcome it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, in other words, you're saying that past 2025, when there's a what they call a CETA bill in Washington that would prohibit that, would it be possible to ship that power to elsewhere outside of Washington? It probably would. Logistically, it probably could happen. Could it economically work, not sure, but the Washington Act is basically prohibits coal power coming into Washington, and that's so it could possibly, but that hadn't come up, and I'm just giving my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All right, members, if you would, I have four questions, and there's no way we're going to have time to have, and I want every one of the owners to answer these four questions. So if I would, Ms. Burry, can you track, and I can give you these questions because I've written them down, and I'll just offer it to everybody in the room who's the owners. So that's basically Mr. Ebsery, Mrs. Lewis, Mr. Deneau, Mr. Hoffman, and Mr. Taylor. And I would like a written response so that we can get out of here tonight at some time decent, but I would like an answer to these four questions. First one, are you calling for a reduction of full-time employees in the maintenance and operations budget beyond what has been proposed by Talon? That's my first question. And I'm not going to ask any of you up to the podium. I just want this in writing for us. Number two, and again, you don't have to catch up to this because I'll have Ms. Burry send it out as an email for all of us. Number two, in the last 6 months, have you had any correspondence with any environmental organizations like the MEIC, the Sierra Club, or others about closure of Colstrip 3 or 4? And if so, I'd like a copy of that. Number three, what is the time frame that your individual owners of Colstrip are considering a 0% depreciation of Colstrip? In other words, I expect it to be at 2025, and if Northwest Energy wants to go to 2045, we're not going to pay beyond 2025. So that kind of, that's the point of my question. And then number four, for everybody, do you plan to continue to operate if Northwest Energy decides to stay in this longer, because Northwest Energy, I believe, is depreciating out to about 2045. So Montana would like to use this coal power to 2045. So in your arbitration that you guys have coming up, is it your position to get out of this as soon as you're at 0% depreciation, or would you allow the continued investment of the O&M? Because if you didn't, it would sure as heck shut down Colstrip 3 and 4 beyond the lifespan that Northwest Energy sets it. Those are my four questions. And then as much as I would like to ask Ms. Hedges a question, I cannot resist Ms. Trunnell. So I've thought of the perfect yes or no question for you, Ms. Trunnell. If you would please, this will be my final question. And I'm only going to ask this because when you started out that you were a student. I misunderstood you saying you were a teacher. Then in your discussion, you basically said that you were a lawyer. And then you said you've litigated for the MCC. So I'm trying to piece together your involvement in this beyond just a citizen. So my question for you is, were you involved in the lawsuit in any way with MEIC on the shutdown of Colstrip 1 and 2? Yes or no? Thank you. Excellent. That's all I've got. Let's go to the... Actually, I have one final question for the bill sponsor.
Chairman Skies, I do have the percentages of ownership and the termination provision of the contract as well, if that would be helpful to the committee.
Thank you so much. So, good Senator, we've heard a lot tonight, and maybe this will be part of your conclusion. Maybe I'll help take away part of your conclusion. Maybe I'll add to it. We've heard chilling effect, communism, one of my favorite words to be used because I'm totally against that, of course, changing contracts, picking winners and losers. What about the politics of out-of-state headquartered companies being compelled by their state regulators to pursue actions that damage or attempt to shut down a vital component of Montana's industry and power generation? What about that? Is that unconscionable?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a great question, and I think that's ultimately the issue. Before I deviate, your first part of your question on the constitutionality, I did prepare a legal memo for those of you who would like to read it, and I will pass it around because it's applicable to both, but I think you can see in the analysis there's nothing unconstitutional about this bill. Or the next one.
And then, Senator, was there a legal review, a legal note for this bill? Since we're on the subject?
Not to my recollection, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Or not that I know of, so I'm not aware of one. But as you can see, I have prepared an analysis for you to look at. If you'd like to, it goes through the analysis of how contracts are impaired and whether or not that leads to a constitutional violation. I think just from a common sense standpoint, everybody here in this room, I think, can grasp the basic concept that we in the legislature have the power to affect contracts when they affect issues of public policy. And this is a little off the topic, but if you think about your normal criminal enterprise, most of those are contracts. The sale of drugs is a contractual activity. But we certainly have the power here in the legislature to affect that type of change and to void those and make those illegal. So just because we affect a contract doesn't make it unconstitutional. So I think that's just an important point. But I think back to the main point here is we have West Coast utilities basically refusing to stand up to West Coast regulators, and really they're ended up sticking us with really a terrible burden. They're shutting down a main source of power for us, important power, that baseload power, that the type that you can count on in the middle of winter, things that keep the lights on when the wind stops blowing. And I think from just terms of sovereignty here, I mean, we talk a lot about being our own state and having our own sovereignty. We need to push back against out-of-state regulators and other states that are trying to push us around and dictate what we do in our future. This is really what this bill is about. It's about our future in Montana, not whether they want to have coal power in Washington State. If they want to have all wind power in Washington State, so be it. But they shouldn't be able to come into Montana and tell us how we're going to run our state and what types of power we're going to have and what types of things that our utilities can do. I mean, that at the end of the day is what this is about. This is about the sovereignty of Montana and making sure that we can do what we want to do in the state of Montana, and we're not going to be stuck with the dictates of the Washington Utility Commission. So on that point, I think that really is, it's a key point here. I think this is really, at the end of the day, this is a sovereignty bill, and it's really a sovereignty bill for all of us.
And Senator, before you conclude, I just want to throw out one more thing. Mr. Rose, you're not going to get SJ-10 and SJ-3 without HB-273, so I'd add that to your narrative. So please, Senator, could you close on your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. Just a couple points here. The statute that we're talking about is the Montana Consumer Protection Act. This is a statute that applies to consumer transactions that you have right now. If you walk down to the grocery store and you don't like the eggs they sold you, you consume under the Montana Consumer Protection Act. If you don't like the power that Northwestern provided with you, you consume under the Montana Consumer Protection Act. All we're doing is extending this same law, which affects every consumer transaction in the state of Montana to this utility network. So this is not a radical thing. I don't think it's that big of a deal for them to comply with it and follow the law. But I think I've hit the main points I wanted to in my close. This is really, I think, again, a Montana bill, making sure that we have a Montana solution. And I would like to push back, I'm sorry, one more point, and I apologize, Mr. Chair. It was said here that everybody's happy and we're just all good citizens, and suddenly out of the blue we got a budget approved. Well, there may be a reason for it, and I have a letter, and we can get it to you. It's from March 17th of 2021, so just last week. This is from DEQ, and this is DEQ writing to Talon, Montana, as the operator, and this is what they put in the letter, and this probably explains why suddenly we have a budget. It says, and I'm going to read you the third paragraph. DEQ has become aware that ownership partners in the Colstrip Steam Electric Station may have evaluated and set funding for the ongoing operation and maintenance of this facility below historical norms. I am concerned that, should this be true, the Colstrip facility may find itself in non-compliance with the applicable requirement, thereby subjecting the facility to possible enforcement actions brought not only by the DEQ, but by the Environmental Protection Agency and or citizens. In addition, economic implications of non-compliance to the town of Colstrip and the state of Montana should be significant. Now, I don't think that you should have to wait to get a letter from a regulator to tell you to get your budget straightened away so that you get in compliance with the law. You should be doing that anyways. And not only that, talk about good corporate citizens. Puget Sound, and there's another letter here, they paid part of their bill under protest. So think about what that means. They paid their share of the maintenance under protest. So they're protesting the salaries that they're paying for people. They're protesting their obligation to provide environmental requirements. They're protesting everything. Paying of pensions. That's not being a good corporate citizen.
So, Senator, please, let's try and keep our emotions in. We got another whole bill to go.
I know. I apologize, Mr. Chair, but I think you see the point here. We need to make sure that this facility is running. There's people that live and depend on it, citizens of Montana, obviously the people that work there, of course. But, you know, I don't think that leaving environmental protection obligations that are required under the Clean Air Act and something like that and letting those go for months without paying those bills is appropriate. So I'd ask you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 266. And we're going to have the vice chair run this next one.
All right, members of the committee, this will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 265. Senator Fitzpatrick, would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to be here again. Final bill for you. It's been hinted at, and we've discussed it briefly, but this is the next one. I'm sorry, for the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10. The next bill is Senate Bill 265, and what this does is it simply changes the way arbitration proceedings are conducted. You've heard a lot of discussion about arbitration, and what that is it's simply an out-of-court process where a person you pick as an arbitrator more or less functions as a judge. And arbitration has many benefits. It can be faster. It can be cheaper. You don't have to go through a lot of the technicalities that you do in ordinary litigation. So what this does very simply is it changes the process for arbitration. So the arbitration will occur here in the state of Montana and will be before a panel of three people. And the rationale here is very simple. First of all, as you probably, if you want to look through the large contracts that were dropped off here, the arbitration is supposed to occur in the state of Washington, picked by an arbitrator, or the arbitrator is picked by a judge in Spokane County. This simply changes it so it says the arbitration occurs in Montana. There will be three arbitrators, not one, and they will be chosen by the selection process when the American Arbitration Association rules. The reason for that is very simple. This is a facility in Montana. I think it's more appropriate to do the arbitration here, but also it's important to have three arbitrators. That way you're not stuck with the decision of one people. It's more or less we're saying here three brains are better than one, and that way you can ensure that one person's beliefs or views on things like energy and coal don't necessarily guide the way, and we can have a more balanced decision. Think of it as the same process in our court system. When you appeal to the Montana Supreme Court, you get a panel of anywhere from five to seven judges. If you're in the federal system, you would appeal up to the Ninth Circuit. You could have a panel anywhere from three up to, I think it's somewhere of like 13 or 17. So three minds, I guess, are better than one. Make sure that we don't get any off-the-wall rulings, and I think that will result in, I think, a fair decision for everybody. And really, I don't think there's any reason why we can't trust arbitrators from Montana. I don't know why anybody would think that a Montana citizen can do a good job on an arbitration. So with that, I'd ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Really quick, before we open it up to proponents and opponents, you can stay there, Mr. Hoffman. I just wanted to note to the committee that when setting up today's schedule, it was my intent to have 266 and then 265, so we could kind of have those longer testimonies and kind of really hash things out and hopefully have a clearer picture for this bill. So with that, just everybody... you know, you don't have to repeat your testimony word for word from the last bill since it's still pretty fresh in our minds. So with that, we'll open to proponents in the room, please.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. David Hoffman with Northwestern Energy. It's spelled H-O-F-F-M-A-N. And in the interest of time, I was going to ask that my prior testimony be incorporated into the testimony on this bill by reference, if that's possible.
Yes, that is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. From my prior testimony, you know that we consider our share of Colstrip a viable part of our portfolio. We want to operate or take power from Colstrip as long as useful and economic. When that glide path ends, we don't know. We think it's 2042, which is our depreciation schedule. We have initiated arbitration under the O&O agreement February 9th. And the arbitration has to do with this issue of whether a vote on a budget could actually effectively close the plant or if there needed to be a unanimous decision to close the plant. And we would prefer under this bill arbitration be in Montana than in the state of Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Next proponent, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, here on behalf of Talon, Montana. While we are, our parent company is technically an out-of-state company, we're perfectly fine with the provisions associated with this bill. I spoke a little bit about our CEO and the public statements that he made at within the last couple of years. So just by way of further description around that. So at the Senator Daines Energy Summit, Ralph Alexander, our CEO, was one of the keynote speakers. And his final closing comments about Colstrip was pretty clear. Colstrip is an asset that belongs to the state of Montana. We as the co-owners are really more stewards of that asset. He believes that. This is really up to the state of Montana and you as policymakers to help shepherd the future of Colstrip if you too believe that Colstrip is an asset for the state of Montana. Relative to Senate Bill 265, we believe that it makes sense to have the arbitration occur where the asset physically exists. So we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Next proponent, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T, representing the Montana AFL-CIO. We believe that if arbitration is necessary to determine the future of Units 3 and 4, and in turn the community of Colstrip, that should take place in Montana, so we'd ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Next proponent, please.
Madam Vice Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is John Forkan, F-O-R-K-A-N, representing the Montana State Building Trades Council. Well, we rise in support of this. If you're going to have arbitration that's going to affect a Montana business and impact Montana workers, we think that venue should be set in the state of Montana, and we would ask you for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forkan.
Vice Chair, committee members, good afternoon. Dwight Rose, ROSE, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I will do the infamous Me Too. Keep it short. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent in the room. Seeing none and having none registered online, we'll move to opponents in the room, please.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Tom Ebsery again, E-B-Z-E-R-Y. I think Senator Representative Skies and you have laid out that we had a lengthy hearing before. Let me say on behalf of Portland General Electric and Avista, our problem is not the fact that we think that you're going to get a bad deal in Montana. Our argument and why this bill should not go is the fact that the agreement that is now before you specifically states that if there are terms that signed in 1981, that if there are disagreements, it be done by arbitration, and it be done at in Spokane. Probably at that time it was done because you had West Coast, Puget, and Avista, and Montana Power, and they felt that maybe that was a central location. I don't think there was any intent to favor one state or another. We believe that 265 as it tends to override the terms and conditions of the existing agreement that clearly specifies the venue and location for the arbitration and the number of arbitrators. And I think there's been reference made to it. I believe we had a hearing in the Senate sometime in February, and at least from our standpoint, we did not know that Northwestern had already triggered the arbitration clause, and now is they're in procedures of that, and I think they're in what they call a quiet period for 30 days, and maybe we're in that now. but we weren't aware of that, or at least the lobby team was not aware that that had been triggered by Mr. Hines from Northwestern, and we have some serious questions as to whether or not they are going to, should this bill pass, try to employ and upside down the arbitration that's already in place. We believe that this flies in the face of the Federal Arbitration Act, and we believe that so far the agreement has served well, and all of a sudden bringing in three Montana arbitrators may be fine, but that should be worked out amongst the owners and not to make the legislature be the referee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Emsery. Next opponent, please.
Yes, Ms. Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Lewis, and I'm here today on behalf of Puget Sound Energy. Practically speaking, if Senate Bill 265 passes in current form, the states of Montana and Washington could be exposed to protracted litigation, and the only direct beneficiaries would be the attorneys involved, not Colstrip. Further, the bill attempts to change negotiated provisions of the owners and operating agreement that's been in place for 40 years, a substantial impairment to the longstanding contractual relationship between the owners raises constitutional questions and should be avoided entirely. It also raises questionable precedent about the state's business climate at a time that the state of Montana is trying to attract businesses to the state to help with a comeback. Arbitration is definitely a private proceeding between parties involved. It is not the place of state government to dictate where and how arbitration should take place. Please oppose this bill so Puget Sound Energy may continue to work directly with the five Colstrip owners, the community, and the administration to find constructive private sector solutions to address this complicated topic in a manner that appropriately balances the needs of all states and all parties involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, I'm Charles Deneau, D-E-N-O-W-H, here on behalf of Rocky Mountain Power. Our opposition is similar to that of the last bill. We view this as interference by the state in a private agreement, and we think it sends a bad message to those looking to invest in Montana. So we urge you to table the bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Zolnikov, representatives of the committee, Monica Trenell, and since there seemed to be a little bit of confusion about my background, I will just clarify, I'm here as a private citizen. I'm probably the only person in the room not getting paid to be here. I grew up in eastern Montana, and I was a lawyer. I was a staff attorney at the Public Service Commission and for the Consumer Council, and I represent a number of private businesses in front of the commission now, today. So, with respect to Senate Bill 265, this is a government intrusion into private industry, which, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is communism. Look at Section 18 of the contract. I would like the two exhibits that I introduced earlier for Senate Bill 266 to be considered as part of the record for 265. Section 18 of the owner-operator agreement is titled Arbitration. It's at the bottom page number is 21 of this page. And I'm curious, actually, if the people who wrote this bill read this contract before they decided to rewrite it. Because the first sentence of this arbitration clause says that the arbitrator can be picked anybody having expertise in the matter submitted. So Senator Fitzpatrick could be the arbitrator under the current contract. The government doesn't need to do this. The government doesn't need to rewrite these private industries, private contracts. Look at this arbitration clause, please. If the project users can't mutually agree on an arbitrator underneath the contract as written today, an arbitrator is appointed by the Spokane District Court. Arbitrators are selected from a national arbitrator base. So you can get a Montana arbitrator. And whether they're sitting in a room in a hotel in Billings, in Colstrip, in Kalispell, or Spokane, is not going to affect the outcome. And if these people don't like the way this arbitration provision is written, why'd they sign this contract? Government has no place in Montana rewriting and taking over private business the way these bills are doing it. And to the sponsor's point of sovereignty, that's fine. But let's not live in a communist state, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Trunell. Are there further opponents in the room? Seeing none and having none listed online, as well as no informational witnesses, are there informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, we will go to questions from the committee. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I can start out with a question from Ms. Trunell, please.
Ms. Trunell.
Thank you, Chairman Zolnikoff. Representative Olson.
Chairman Zolnikoff, Ms. Trunell. For me, looking at this bill, I have two red flags for me that are a concern. And I'm just wondering if there's a solution. So one, that it's retroactive. That's always concerning to me that we do something that's retroactive in the law, because if it affects somebody, that puts us in the frame for being held accountable for those kinds of damages sometimes. The second thing that's concerning to me is we're taking the entire Arbitration Act and we are finding that we're changing the venue just for one kind of company, for just electrical companies, right? And so I'm wondering if we did two things, if at least we get rid of these problems, if we made the, or are we just making it worse? If we were to take Section 2 and not make it just for electric companies, but we made it for all contracts, that you couldn't enter into a Montana contract without having the venue for Montana. Sounds problematic at things for some companies, and for some, for consumer contracts, that would be a good thing, right? So, but that would eliminate this being just outright special legislation for one or a handful of companies, right? Would there still be problems with this bill if we were to eliminate this special treatment for one kind of company and the fact that it's retroactive?
Thank you, Representative Olson, Chairman Zolnikoff, members of the committee. With respect to the retroactivity and the unconstitutionally of being a special privilege for one corporation, I think those are clearly issues with this bill. But I think the larger issue to which you are addressing the question and that the members of the committee really need to consider is it necessary for the government to rewrite private contracts? Is that really where we want to be? These parties knew what they were doing. They had well-paid lawyers negotiating this arbitration provision, and they agreed to it. We don't need to be rewriting private contracts. How many contracts in Montana are you going to find in court being litigated under this statute? I don't think there's a fix to this statute, to the proposed to Senate Bill 265, other than killing it. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you. Ms. Trunell, thank you. Madam Chair, can I follow up with the sponsor, please?
Senator Fitzpatrick.
Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, I guess I'll ask the same question of you. If it's a good idea for us to have arbitration done in Montana for all the reasons that you mentioned, why would you create a special law that is unconstitutional, having a law that applies specially to one contract and one group of people? Why wouldn't you have made this change to the Arbitration Act apply to all businesses in Montana?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, first of all, I disagree with you. Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, both of you, so you're two wonderful chairmen here. First of all, I disagree with the assertion that these are unconstitutional, and you have my memo, and you're obviously an attorney, so you can read it and disagree. I know we disagree on many legal issues, so we can have that disagreement, but the reason I did this and the reason we have this bill is because, again, we have a very, I think, important issue to the state of Montana, a very important public policy issue, and that's whether we keep Colstrip open and keep it funded and maintained. I realize there are people here that want to close Colstrip, and that's been very clear in their testimony. So, but that's the idea here is we want to make sure that...
Representative Olson, do you want a point of clarification?
Yeah, I actually didn't ask the question you're answering, Mr. Senator Fitzpatrick. I am very interested in why. So I hear you saying that you are doing this to keep Colstrip open. So yes, Madam Chair, can I clarify? Sorry.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick. I guess what my question is. I've got that question. I'll move on to a different one. In the retroactive, if we did not make this bill retroactive, would it then not solve the problem because Northwest Energy has already filed an arbitration request?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I think if I understand your question here, taking out the retroactivity, I think it's important that it is retroactivity because we have such an important issue coming up in the Northwestern arbitration. This is, if you've read the arbitration letter, it fundamentally goes to the issue of whether these companies are going to be able to close down the plant. It's right there in the letter. So, again, I think it goes back to this very important public policy issue is whether the West Coast utilities should be able to shut down Colstrip.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick. Madam Chair, would you, is it possible that the Secretary actually posts these documents on Teams, or are they already there? Because I can't seem to find the ones that I've been referred to that are right in front of me.
Representative Olson, I don't think they are in Teams yet, as we just got them today, but I'm getting the head nod from Ms. Burry that she will upload them after the hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Burry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Do you want to go and then I'll go? Or do you want? Okay. I have a question for, well, I have really one question for two people. So I'll start with Mr. Hoffman.
Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Hoffman, my question is, why did you trigger an arbitration if you don't like the terms of the arbitration?
Madam Vice Chair, that was the option that was available to us under the O&O agreement, so we jumped on that. We triggered the arbitration because the owners were not funding or agreeing to fund the 21 budget.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Chair Skies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is for the bill sponsor.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair and good Senator, we've heard in testimony that, and I use the quotes, one kind of company, in other words, you're trying to change the contracts for one kind of company. Shouldn't we do it for all companies? Doesn't there need to be a point of clarification that isn't every single one of these companies besides Talon actually state-regulated monopolies?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I'll make sure I get that the order right.
Welcome to House Energy.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Talon is a merchant operator, as you know, so they sell power on the open market, and everybody else is a regulated utility, so they're subject to regulation. But I want to disagree with the point that this is for one type of company. All companies under my bill would be able to use this arbitration provision. All we're saying is the arbitration has to occur in Montana before three people. And honestly, I'm having a hard time listening to and understanding what the big deal is. Why can't we trust an arbitration in the state of Montana? What's so great about Washington versus Montana? I mean, the plant's here. What's wrong with having three people do an arbitration? This isn't that big of a deal. I mean, but it is an important one to make sure we have a fair arbitration.
Verification.
I'll do a follow-up, please.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, good Senator, so could you explain to us, for the record, because obviously this is where we establish legislative intent, why did you want to go from just one arbitrator according to the agreement and switch to three?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, good question. We wanted to have three arbitrators to make sure that you get kind of that balanced decision, that good decision that you get from having three people look at an issue. Sometimes you'll have one person, and I'll give you an example. It happens all the time, and when I'm at court, you'll have a judge, and you know, for whatever reason, they'll enter a decision, and you're like, that's just not right. I mean, and you get three people looking at an issue, and you know, somebody may say, you know, maybe you're wrong here. So you get, you know, basically we're getting three brains. Like I said, three brains, I think, on these topics, because they're very, very complex, very complicated, would be better than one. And I think it would ensure at the end of the day you'll get a good, thorough vetting of the issues instead of just having one person do it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Madam Chair, if you would, one final follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good, Senator. So, obviously, we've discussed why we want to bring it from Spokane to here, but I want to dive back into the issue of who picks the arbitrators. And it's basically all the owners, right? And so, by our recollection, we have six owners. Two have been consistent proponents of these bills. Four have been consistent opponents of these bills. Is it fair to assume that those four would appoint an arbitrator in Spokane that would endorse what they want?
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, so the way the contract works is the judge in Spokane County will pick the arbitrator. The way my bill is written, there will be three, and they'll be picked under the American Arbitration Association rules. So I think one side would pick an arbitrator, the other side would pick an arbitrator, and then they would, you know, mutually decide on the third one, is the way I understand the rules.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator.
Follow-up question or further questions from the committee? Representative Durham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Trunell, please.
Thank you, Chairman Zolnikov. Representative Durham.
Madam Chair, Ms. Trunell, thank you for bringing your expertise to this discussion. I like analogies. It helps make complex things more understandable. And perhaps if this was a sandbox and we had six kids with their toys or sharing the same toy, it feels like, if you could expand on my analogy, maybe make it clearer, does it feel like some kids are trying to take their toys from the toy box?
Representative Durham, Chairman Zolnikov, apologize if I didn't do that in the right order. Let me run with it. So we're in a sandbox, you got six kids, and they're playing with their toys. And let's just say those six kids are all 10-year-old girls, and they've all agreed on the rules of the game. And they said, okay, we're going to have the roads be on this side of the sandbox, and we're going to have the dolls be over here, and we're going to have the trucks be over here, and here's how we're going to play the game. And they all have a great time, and they're having a super lot of fun. And they also say, when they start out their game in the sandbox, they all say, you know what, if somebody takes somebody else's truck and we get in a fight, we're all going to agree that Sally's mom is going to come and solve the problem for us. That's how we're going to play our game. That's how we're going to work in the sandbox. And that's how we're going to solve any problems we run into. So they go along when they're 30, they're 40, they're 50, and they're still playing their game in the sandbox. And all of a sudden, one of them decides, well, she doesn't like Sally's mom anymore. So she's going to go get five other parents who happen to be government people, and they're going to rewrite the whole agreement that these people agreed to play in the sandbox. So that's how the analogy plays out. They made the rules, they agreed on the game, they played by it, they benefited from it to the tune of millions and millions of dollars on our backs. And now Northwestern doesn't like the way the sandbox works anymore for it, because it thinks it's going to close down. And this isn't about coal.
Representative Durham, did that answer your question?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could follow up for clarification.
Follow up.
And so Sally's mom, if we could kind of put the picture for her, is this Sally's mom, or is Sally's mom a judge in Washington, or is it the judicial system, or is the legislative system of Montana?
Sally's mom could be the man in the moon. It's the person they agreed to. It doesn't matter. They agreed on the rules of the game. And this is about Northwestern not liking the rules of the game and coming crying to the people it thinks it controls.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's not right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Zolnikoff. Thank you, Representative Durham. I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Olson.
Thank you. I'd like to try to ask my question of Mr. Ebsbury, if I may, Madam Chair.
Mr. Ebsbury.
Ebsbury. The B is before the Z.
Mr.
Vice
Ebsbury.
Chair. Representative Olson, 38 years. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ebsbury. My question goes again to what we're actually changing, which is the Arbitration Act. So I do believe that we can't create special legislation that applies to just one company. But even if we wanted to open this up and say that this good change, that a arbitration had to be in Montana, with the choice of three Montana arbitrators, and I think maybe that's not a bad idea, but is that something we can actually do, or would that violate not only contracts that have already been entered into? So I'm now thinking forward. So if we were to change this bill so that it started in the future, not a retroactive bill, and that it allowed all contracts in Montana, required all contracts into Montana to be arbitrated in Montana, can we do that? Or is that a violation of the federal act in any way?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Olson, I don't know about the Federal Arbitration Act. Our concern would be is that we have an existing agreement. There could be an incentive for the agreement to be amended by the owners to provide a different venue. But in terms of dictating that by statute to an existing agreement, we have that's our problem. The question is with three arbitrators. That may be in the future, that may be, but I think that the existing agreement is the one that everyone signed and that they're on. I would leave it up to the owners to see if they wanted to amend that agreement at some time in the future that would provide for this. But remember, this is a 1981 agreement, but it's still in full of compliance or agreement.
So thank you, Mr. Ebsbury. Madam Chair, I guess maybe somebody else in the room. I mean, literally, if we're not talking about one company, and we're not talking about just Colstrip, and we're not talking about just overriding one agreement, what we're really doing in this bill is changing the Arbitration Act in Montana. And it doesn't seem like we can talk about that without talking about this agreement. And so is there any attorney in the room that would like to try to address the act without talking about whether or not it affects this agreement or not? Okay. Oh, sorry.
Chairman Zolnikoff, Chairwoman Zolnikoff, Representative Olson, I'd like to take a swing at that, if I may.
Thank you.
I think what we're talking about here is rewriting an arbitration agreement. How can we get businesses who want to invest billions of dollars in Montana to come here if we're going to be rewriting contracts? That's socialism. We need to be very careful. I'm talking to businesses who are interested in investing here, rewriting this contract in this way when it doesn't need to be rewritten. Read the arbitration provision. They're arbitrating under it now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Madam
Trunell.
Chair, with Ms. Trunell.
Ms. Trunell.
Thank you, Chair, Chairman Zolnikoff.
Madam Chair, Ms. Trunell, if we were to pass a change to the Arbitration Act that was in the future, it didn't apply retroactively to this contract that we've been discussing so much today, and it was stated essentially that all arbitration clauses entered into in Montana had to have the option, if not the mandatory requirement, that they be arbitrated in Montana. Do you think that would still have a chilling effect on business?
The idea of how and where contracts need to be litigated is heavily negotiated in any transaction. When you have joint owners of anything, they always discuss that. You have investors from New York, from Seattle, from even from different countries. They work through these provisions carefully and negotiate them carefully, as these owners did. So rewriting this now will have the effect of government rewriting contracts, which is socialism, and we should not do. Thank you, Chairman Zolnikoff. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Ms. Turnell. I feel like we're getting a little in the weeds here with hypotheticals, so I'm going to just bring us out just a little bit. I think I understand what you're trying to ask, Representative Olson, but if you're not, I am curious, and this was one of my questions as well. So question for Ms. Lewis, please.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. My question is, what will happen to the specific arbitration that has already been triggered that is going on right now if this bill is passed? Is it going to be thrown out? What is going to happen?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, thank you for the question. I honestly do not know, and I'm not sure that anybody in the room knows. I would ask the sponsor or perhaps Mr. David Hoffman.
Mr. Hoffman.
Madam Vice Chair, I'm sorry, would you repeat the question?
Yes, Mr. Hoffman, my question is, what is going to happen with the arbitration that has already been triggered that on, I think, February 9th was what I wrote down? What is going to happen to that arbitration should this bill pass?
I guess if the, Madam Vice Chair, I guess if the retroactivity clause is solid, then we would be arbitrating in Montana.
So would the results of this arbitration just be kind of cast away then? Would a new one be initiated?
Madam Vice Chair, no, I think we would stick with this cycle that we started on February 9th.
So then would you add two additional arbitrators in Montana, or how would that look?
Madam Vice Chair, we haven't even gotten to that stage in the arbitration yet, so I think it would be chicken-egg kind of thing, depending on when and if this were to pass.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Durham.
Madam Chair, for perspective question, Mr. Tom Ebsery, please.
Mr. Ebsery.
Hopefully we can get out of the weeds and back into the sandbox.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Durham.
Mr. Ebsery, back to the simple analogy of the sandbox, and some of the kids have matured beyond the desire to use the toys in the sandbox, and balanced with that perspective of asset versus liability, because I hear concerns on both sides. And also to make sure I understand the interest of the different parties, the coal strip plants, do they also control portions of coal that's still unmined?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Durham, the coal mined at Colstrip is by a coal contract, I think a 3-year coal contract with Westmoreland Resources, and they supply the coal, and that's so it's nothing to do with the plant, and the coal is separate.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ebsery, so all we're talking about is the furnace that makes the electricity?
Madam Vice Chair, well stated.
Chairman Skies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would really like to ask Mr. Ebsery the pending question of, after 38 years of service, do you think that term limits have destroyed that component of it? But that's nothing to do with the bill, so I won't ask it.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you for the question. I prefer not to answer. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? All right, I just have one quick question for the sponsor, and then we'll let you do your close. Senator Fitzpatrick, my question is, would you still support and sponsor this bill if these arbitration laws applied to all companies across Montana equally?
Madam Chair, good question. I generally like arbitration, so I would have no problem with a piece of legislation that expanded arbitration. In fact, I think it's very disappointing that we've had over the years legislation passed by this body, before my time even here, where we really restricted the ability of people to do arbitrations. So I think they're good. I brought a bill, that's kind of off topic, but I brought a bill many years ago that allowed construction liens to be arbitrated. So I think arbitration is a good thing, I do think, from my experience as a lawyer, on complex ones, I would actually prefer three. That's just my personal opinion.
Thank you. Go ahead and close on your bill if you'd like to.
I would. Thank you for the good hearing, good questions. At the end of the day, I think really this is, it's about, when you think about this bill, I think we've gotten really off topic on some of the testimony we've heard here, but this is really at the end of the day about making sure that we have three minds looking at very complex issues, interpretations of, you know, fairly complex documents, very thorough contracts, and I think having three people in the state of Montana looking at that would be a benefit to everybody. And really, I have a hard time really understanding what the big deal is from the opponents. I mean, if the outcome is going to be the same, like one person said, then what's wrong with having three people in the state of Montana look at this contract? I mean, this isn't going to hurt anybody. I think the arbitrators will give the result. They give the result, but at least we don't have to worry about getting a off-track decision. We have three people making sure we get a fair decision, and I think that's really what it's about, making sure we get a fair decision. So that, I appreciate your time. I realize we've gone late, but I do appreciate the time today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. This concludes the hearing on Senate Bill 265.
Excellent job, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you so much. Okay, folks, I know we have Senate Bill 297. We didn't go through today, but keep that close because, like I said, I think it's a big revenue bill. We're going to have to do it by next Wednesday, and it's going to have a bunch of that potential COVID money that we could use to expand broadband. And so don't lose that one, Edel, because they won't put it back on your table, so make sure it goes in your folder so we have it available. And for those folks online, realize we're going to reschedule that. And so for the remainder, I'd love to discuss what our future looks like. We have a couple deadlines coming up. The transmittal deadline for amendments is basically the 16th of April. So for us to make sure it gets out, gets right across the rostrum, gets passed, gets put in a second, gets it done by third, that's the 12th. So for us, the 12th is really the final deadline if you want to modify anything before us. I don't know that we'll get bills after the 12th. We might. I'm not quite sure. But just so you know, let's look at the stuff that we've got coming up before us. If you want to get amendments on it, make sure we get ahead of this with Mr. Graff, and let's get those components in there. The next big deadline we have, of course, is next Wednesday, which is let me get my calendar up. Thank you. It's the 31st, so it's the last day of March. That's the last day. Well, actually, Thursday, the 1st is the last day. But for us, because we meet on Wednesdays and not Thursdays, is the last day for revenue bills to get out of the committee. And like I said, one we just heard, Representative Fitzgerald's bill, 653, is a revenue bill. This 297 is going to be a gigantic revenue bill. Senator Regeer's Senate Bill 81 for the prepaid wireless, that's a revenue bill. So we have to do executive at least on those three by next Wednesday. And then we have a bunch of other bills remaining, but here would be my plan for the committee. Because we've worked so hard, I know we took Monday off, but technically we worked the House Bill 2, even though that went really smooth. I still want to take Friday off, and I think we can do it. So I'm not going to have an energy committee meeting this Friday. Then what that does is it leaves us Monday. We're going to hear Andrea Olson's bill. I'm sorry, Representative Olson's bill, H.R. 4, and Representative Running Wolf's bill, H.B. 657. And that pretty much should catch us up to those that are not yet scheduled and referred. We might have one or two bills beyond that. I'm not quite sure. But we'll hear both of those on Monday. And then Monday and Wednesday of next week, we have the time frames before us to at least do those revenue bills for executive. So we'll at least do those. Hopefully, we'll have amendments solved by them. Of course, we'll have to work with those two sponsors. And so then by the 31st, before we go to Easter break on the 2nd, because that affects our committee meetings on the 2nd and the 5th, that's Friday and Monday, which, of course, we will not be here. Then that leaves us the 7th and the 9th of April to work through all the remaining components we have. So I wouldn't mind, with the committee's indulgence, I definitely think we can get it because we're a pretty good, aggressive committee. So on the 7th and the 9th, so basically by Friday the 9th of April, I'm hoping to have executive done on everything we've got. And so let's work together with Trevor Graff, Mr. Graff, to make sure we have amendments. Let's talk to the sponsors. Please do me a favor. If you're working on an amendment for a sponsor's bill, get with that sponsor so that way you can tell us when you move that amendment, if the sponsor approves it or not. That's only a respectful thing to do. It saves us from having to dig up and find these guys and ask them if, you know, or girls, is this acceptable for your bill and whatnot. So let's do that kind of work. So Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. I guess one is following up on those bills we just heard. I was wondering if we could ask Mr. Graff to double check that there wasn't legal notes on those.
Sure, excellent.
And then the question I have, you know, when we heard the suicide hotline bill, you had made a comment about us fixing that. And if we had this deadline coming up and we have all this money, it does seem like the suicide prevention hotline should be something that shouldn't get stuck in this session. And it's in our committee, and we are the ones that have the ability to fix it. And so I'm just wondering if there's movement on that. I think you mentioned when we had the executive action that you thought there would be movement coming on that.
Okay, that would be, could you remind me the bill number? Do you remember?
I keep getting emails on it, 315, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Implement 988 Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Remember, the reason why we just put that one off to the side was because the governor and his Department of Commerce already had a budget line item. It was his bill in Congress, and the governor's implementing it all. And so the only reason we would need a piece of legislation would be to put in code anything that he needed to implement the program. But by talking to his people, they thought they had everything they needed. And so the bill was superfluous. It wasn't needed. It was already funded in the governor's budget. And so everything in the bill was, we just didn't need it. The governor was already working on it.
Is it possible for us to get some language to that effect? Because I didn't realize that we had solved that problem, and I would like to be able, I've really gotten like 100 emails recently on passing that bill because of needing the suicide hotline. I would love to be able to tell people who've written to me that we have solved that problem and that the governor is initiating a hotline.
Okay, excellent.
If you could get it, if you could get that for us.
You bet, Representative. And if you remember, Mr. Story gave us the actual cutout of the Commerce Department's budget. That was how we knew that. But I'll call and follow up and ask for a letter to that effect from somebody.
Yeah, there's going to be a. I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'll dig into that for you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. If I might,
please, sir.
SB 265 and 266 don't have legal notes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. See how incredibly awesome our staff is. Boom, we had that in about 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, so that'll put us hopefully done with executive by the Friday, the 9th of April. That gives us a little bit of a window. I think looking at it from what I see, I think we'll be out of here before the 25th. So that gives us a little bit of a window. Representative Durham.
Mr. Chair, just to make sure we don't step in something in the play playground. I might be working on an older calendar. Yeah, might be something next to the sandbox. My calendar shows April 1st as legislated day 67, and that's the transmittal of appropriation bills. And so as long as it's out of our committee or passed through the House on April 1st.
Okay, excellent question. Here's what we need to do, though. Remember, we've only worked one Saturday. So the original calendar that you have printed up assumed we worked all Saturdays. And so that's why when you really do the math, we're supposed to get out of here May 11th. And so what you need to do is go to the floor, check out that date that's on the floor. And I can't remember what today is, 54?
I just wanted to make sure that you're
yes.
Seeing everything in the driver's seat.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so you can look at the calendar and look for that deadline per the day, but it won't be that day on the calendar. Remember how I said the dates be like a transparency that goes over the top of the calendar, and as we don't work Saturdays, it moves? So just remember that day 65, you're exactly right, which happens by my estimation by Thursday next week would be the day 65 deadline. You know what I'm saying? Because we haven't worked those Saturdays. I know it's complicated.
You're amazing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See, look at this, man. We learned everything we need to know, and then after 4 years, we're done. Out of here. See ya. Thank you, Mr. Graff, for your hard work. Thank you, Ms. Burry, for your hard work. Thank you, Ms. Agerbeck. We couldn't do it without you guys. Does anybody have anything else? Does this plan look acceptable for everybody?
That's fabulous.
I know you guys are really upset with me for giving us Friday off. You know, I'll try and work. I'll try and make it up to everybody. All right, cool. Seeing no further questions, I adjourn House Energy. Thank you, folks. Who's buying whiskey?